There we go. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Ah, that sounds good. That sounds really good. So we're not going to start quite yet because I want to play the intro, but our banter was, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Oh, the siren just went by. Can you still hear me? So that was our pre-show. Oh, what the hell? Here's the... Hey, Soraya, do you want me to play the anti-ETH intro or the regular one or the really old one?
It's up to you.
I want to hear the anti-ETH one. Let's see.
Yeah, I think I was leaning that way, too.
Yeah, me too. Here we go.
No, the whole extraterrestrial thing is not a viable solution to this.
We need to go through a turning point in the study of this whole domain, away from ideology. We're not here to prove that we're being visited by, you know, aliens from this planet or that star. That may very well be true, but we have not done the basic work.
I have this hunch that this phenomenon is comes from some sort of domain of pure information. And the fact that they can interact with us at all suggests that that we inhabit a domain that's also pure information.
Are we go conditioned here? Yes.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
All right, we have the normal amount of between 20 and 30 live listeners for Radio Mysterioso tonight. With let me fade that. Soraya Azkath. Is that how it's pronounced?
That is how it's pronounced.
Okay. Let me fade the music properly. There we go. See, I was fading it at the board. I should be fading it at the computer. How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah?
I'm usually pretty exhausted on Sundays, but I'm feeling all right tonight.
Okay. Well, I hope you're up for the talk.
I am.
Okay, Soraya is the host of Where Did the Road Go, which is a famous podcast which people keep telling me is very favorably compared to what I try to do here. And I've been on Soraya's show a couple of times with...
Just once.
Oh, I thought it was more than once with Red Pill and Joshua.
We talked once, but we weren't actually recording.
Oh, that's right. Okay. You see, every time I'm on with somebody and it's like a radio show type person, I think, oh, they might be recording. So I do not know. But you know what? The cool thing about it is I did not really notice or care when we were recording, just because I think you still have the kind of a idea about doing your show that I do, which is let's just talk about stuff what we want to talk about, and if people listen, great, and if they don't, that's fine too, because we're doing it for our own thing. Is that how you feel about your show?
It kind of depends. I mean, when I do the main show, on the live show on Saturday night, it's usually one guest. We're talking about their work, so it's pretty straightforward then. But when I do the round tables, it's very, very loose.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I try to make it loose with people even when I'm not. But the thing is that some people, they don't know me that well, or I don't know them that well. And so it starts getting kind of stilted, and they're like, question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. No matter how much I try to bait them into some sort of a conversation, they wait for the next question to be fed so they can go. And
right.
that's kind of a tough one, because I'd rather just have a regular conversation. The secret person I had on the other day that I recorded at home was Chris Aubeck, who's the co-author of Wonders in the Sky with Jacques Vallée.
Right.
You've talked to him, haven't you?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. He was a good interview. I really had a lot of fun talking to him, but it took a while to like break him out of that, you know, question answer thing. So, and it was very, very fun talk. He's written a couple other books. Basically, he's on the history. He looks through files and finds old reports of strange things seen in the sky, and then goes through other parts of historical records and finds out if the person that made the report actually lived, if they lived where they said they did, if the sky looked the way they said it did when they saw the thing that they saw in, you know, 1622. Like he'll say, you know, it's a big thing that looked like the moon, but it wasn't the moon. So he'll look up in an astronomy program what was happening on June 16th, 1622 at 12 p.m. in, you know, Leicester, England. Oh, the moon wasn't even up then, so they couldn't have seen the moon. So that kind of stuff.
Wow, that's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. It's a hell of a lot of work. And I think he's one of the few people that are doing it that everybody knows about. He has a group called the Magonia Exchange online, which I hurriedly joined, which is a bunch of people that are very into that, who just comb historical records, looking for strange sightings of things, and then trying to find other records that either back them up, or conversely, which happens a lot, basically find out that the whole story was BS or made up or partially made up or whatever, because a lot of the thing, you know, a lot of the facts don't match up. So,
well, and I mean, those old stories are in a way a lot more valuable, because we didn't have stuff in the sky back then, so we couldn't dismiss it as man-made craft.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, that's why that's one of the questions I asked him. Why did they stop at 1879? He said, well, that's when people started on a larger scale, and when more people knew about it, started to take to the air in balloons, and very soon after that in gliders and other flying machines. So I said, well, what about balloons like in France in the 18th century? And he said, no, well, it's the thing is that you could pretty well establish that something's a balloon by the way people talk about it.
Right.
Because I actually, you know, in the book here that I'm working on that I'm pretty much done with, there was one article I wrote about the first UFO crash, and it was basically a balloon in the late 18th century in France that crashed out in the country, and the people out in the country had never seen such a thing, and they completely freaked out about it. They saw it coming down over the town. It fell to the ground, and they all came up to it armed with pitchforks and things, and dogs were barking at it and everything, and they poked a hole in it, and all this horrible-smelling hydrogen gas came out. It was a gas balloon. And then they when they realized that it wasn't moving and they thought it might be dead, they sliced it to pieces and then tied it to the tail of a horse, and it ran off through the fields dragging it behind. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So anyway, that was it's like, see what happens when people, you know, they had no idea what the thing was, so they just thought it was some evil, vicious sky monster, you know, that had gotten into some kind of trouble and happened to fall down in their town somehow.
And now, you know, even especially in the last 10 years with drones becoming more and more affordable, I mean, everyone has drones.
Yeah.
And so you see a weird light moving in the sky, and your best guess, it's probably a drone. And it's hard to dismiss unless it's going to shoot across the sky at a million miles an hour.
Yeah. Well, that's a little bit different. I guess it would depend on how it's moving. Somebody asked recently, we're getting very conversational right off the bat. I hope you don't mind.
That's fine.
Somebody asked me recently, well, have you ever seen a video of, because I was like, no, not another stupid video of a light that's moving off in the distance on a shaky camera, which is what, 95% of all videos?
Right.
The only one I can think of that ever really impressed me was one that was supposedly shot from a hotel. Maybe I should stay near the microphone here. From a hotel, supposedly in Vegas, looking north towards the Nellis Air Force Base. There's a mountain, a little mountain at the bottom of the frame, and over the mountain are a group of about five or six lights basically flying up and down in a kind of a loose formation, and they're doing the falling leaf motion when they come down. They go shooting up in the air, and then they kind of drift back down in that falling leaf motion. But, you know, the falling leaf motion, based on the distance they're at, or supposed distance they're at, is like hundreds of yards, or maybe more than that, just going back and forth and settling down towards the ground, then suddenly shooting back up in the air. And they just do this for like a few minutes. That's the most impressive UFO video I've ever seen. Because somebody wanted to fake one, they certainly wouldn't do that. And this was from the 80s. This was from the 80s sometime. And I saw it then. I saw it like in 89, I think.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt there's weird stuff out there. It's just, I mean, it's just so hard to separate nowadays. I mean, I was driving down toward the lake in a small city around here, and I saw a light drop down from the sky, and it was kind of moving really odd, and I'm looking at it going, what is that? And it was a drone. But it was the angle it was at and the way it moved, you know, it looked really weird for a few seconds. It actually looked weird the whole time, and I assumed it was a drone because just on the side of the lake, as I came up a little more, there were a ton of cops. And I'm guessing it was either, you know, from the police, or it was somebody flying their drone over there to see what was going on.
Yeah, I have a drone, a fairly decent one, and I got it to try and make money with. And and I see them all over the place. And I've seen them at, you know, at parties and raves or whatever. And it's especially after last Christmas. I mean, that's why they had that thing where everybody had to register, because they realized that last Christmas everybody and their damn brother would have one. And I go out to the model airplane park to practice, and I see, you know, guys coming out there with their kids, and they've got a $3,000 drone. That's the present they got for Christmas. Like, what the hell are you going to do with this thing? But it's a big, wonderful toy. They all have lights on them. Mine has two red and two green lights, which are not aircraft lights. Those are basically on there just to, you know, because aircraft lights are, you know, red left, green, red left, green right, white tail, and I think strobe on tail, something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
And which I should know since I have the license, but.
The drone that I'm talking about just a moment ago was just one solid white light.
Oh, you okay, know? Yeah, because they all have different kinds of lighting. Some of them don't have any lights, but yeah.
So it definitely looked weird, but it was a pretty good guess. It was probably a drone flown from the city over to the side of the lake to see what was going on.
Right. And at night, so they can see it, and then when they get one of those drone shoot-down things, they can just disable it and have it, you know, basically return or hover. They've got a thing where you can point it at the drone, and it basically cuts off the communications with the base station. And if it does,
really?
Most drones, if they're good ones, if you cut off communication with the base station, they go and they return to the point of origin. Or if they don't have one of those, they either stop and do nothing, or they just land where they are. It's like, well, I'm not being controlled by anybody, so I better just land. It's just built into the drone.
Yeah, I saw another one, too, just the other day, just driving down my road. I'm in the middle of nowhere, and it was just flying over the field very slowly. And initially, I'm like, what is that? And I'm like, that's got to be a drone, because there were like four lights on it. It didn't seem very high in the air.
Yeah.
But if you don't think about it, and you see it in a weird way, it ends up as a UFO report.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how they're going to, you know, I don't know if they're really going to be able to tell the difference anymore. In a lot of ways, because you have to have kind of a database of, like, you know, what drone lights are there, or either that, they just have to eliminate anything that doesn't fly very strangely.
Yeah.
You know, make darting movements and go all the way across the sky in a second or whatever.
And you can easily, you know, put other stuff on a drone, weird lights or any number of things on it to make it look weirder if you feel creative.
Yes. Yeah. And people have done it. Yeah. I've seen them.
So it really does. I mean, modern reports and stuff, just it makes it so much harder.
Yeah. Well, do you think – well, there's a question. Do you think with that in mind, that we should even care about sighting reports anymore?
You know, sighting reports are just adding to the database at this point. It's not telling us anything new.
Right.
And sometimes they're interesting to hear, but for the most part, I don't think they're really that important. We have so many sighting reports that go back throughout history. What do we need a handful more for every year?
Yeah, well, either that or just restrict them to like second, third, and fourth kind or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Even a 500 foot away as definition of first kind is just still kind of like, well, it could be, you know, who knows what that is, unless it's something huge doing very strange maneuvers.
Yeah, well, I've seen one gigantic UFO.
Oh, yeah?
I was driving to my radio station. It was probably 11 o'clock at night. This was back in like 2000. And I'm driving along the lake because I live right in the middle of the Finger Lakes in New York State.
Uh-huh.
So it's all hill. It's like basically, you know, it looks like five fingers scratched out of the landscape.
Yeah.
And they're very, very long lakes. And Cayuga Lake in particular has a history of UFO sightings. And I was driving along there, and from the side of the lake, I just get blinded. And I thought it was somebody driving like a Jeep or something up from the lake out of driveway, and their brights hit me just right. And it's to the point where I turned away and I'm like, wow, okay, turn your brights off. And I waited and it was still blinding me. And I'm like, why is this still blinding me? And I kind of squinted through and look, and there's this gigantic thing over the lake with lights brighter than anything I've ever seen. I couldn't see any physical form. All I could see was these lights. And there were a lot of them. There was like light on top, on the bottom, on each side. And there were lights spinning around it.
Okay, not a drone.
Yeah, definitely not a drone. And I'm looking at it going, what am I looking at? Because I don't jump to the first obvious, you know, oh, it looks like a UFO. And I'm looking at it going, okay, it's not a plane because it's just sitting there. And it's not a helicopter because it doesn't resemble a helicopter whatsoever.
Yeah.
Now, I'm kind of running things through my mind. And I pull over and I roll the window down. There's absolutely no sound. And I'm going, I don't know how far away it is because, you know, it's in the air and you really can't tell. I mean, people think they can, but when something's in the air, you have nothing to compare it to.
Right. Did you say this was at night?
Yeah, this was like 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah, well, see, that makes it even worse.
So I'm watching this thing, and then I realize it's very slowly dropping down toward the lake. And as it's doing that, it moves in front of the trees in front of the lake, and there are these big trees down there. And it must have... There must have been 20 or 30 of them that this thing covered range-wise.
Yeah.
And eventually it dropped below the tree line, and I couldn't see it anymore. And, I mean, there was no weird encounter with it. I didn't have an Oz factor or anything else, but I sat there going, I have no idea what I just saw. You know, I would never say spaceship because yeah, it didn't go into space.
What it was?
You know, it was a bunch of lights that I can't explain. And they stayed in formation with one another, which gave you the impression of a solid object. But I really, you know, I was trying really hard to see if I could actually see an object, and I couldn't.
Uh-huh.
So all I can really say is I saw some lights that stayed in formation and then dropped down into the lake. And I'm thinking, at this point, I'm thinking, could it have been a toy? I was thinking it might have been a toy when it was like before it started dropping down, because I'm thinking maybe that's a lot closer than it looks and it's some kind of new toy. Or drone or something. And then when it started dropping down, I'm like, nope, that's humongous. That's certainly not a toy.
Anybody else see this?
Not that I'm aware of.
Huh.
It seems like something other people would have seen, but I looked for UFO reports after that, and I actually asked on the air when I got to the station and never heard anything.
Huh. Yeah, see, I hear of those things, too, and you start to wonder if those things are just seen by one person or a couple or something.
Yeah.
And even if there are other people around.
Right, and it makes you wonder why, if that's the case, why? Mike Cleland actually had made an interest, asked me a very simple question that I'd never thought about, and he's like, what was going on in your life at the time?
Ah, good question.
And my life was in complete chaos at the time. Like, that was a massive change in a whole bunch of stuff happening right at that moment. And so I'm like, huh, that's really interesting. I never really thought to associate that with what was going on in my life.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's something that I talked to Cassidy Nicholas from MUFON, New York MUFON, actually. couple weeks ago. I'm still doing the edit on that. And I said, hey, you know, is MUFON thinking of doing anything besides asking the same old questions all the time? Like, you know, where did it come from and how big was it? And what it's like, are they starting to ask other questions? Have they thought of maybe like, you know, what's your family background? What, like you said, what's going on in your life? You know, what happened afterwards? Follow up, you know, weeks, months later. Is there a history of any kind of mental problems in your family? Not to say you're crazy. What's going on here? And a whole bunch of other things. You know, look at the area geographically, look at the history of the area, all kinds of things like that. And to my surprise, she actually said, we are moving towards that. In fact, one of the things we're asking right now is, what were you doing right before it happened?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah. So, you know, that seemed like a little bit of some progress to me. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, I've been, you know, talking heavily with people in the last, and I'm sure you're aware of this, and I think I talked about it on your show. Like, what kind of questions should we be asking of the of ourselves and of the phenomenon right now to try and figure it out or figure out what's happening when somebody sees something and reports it? You know, what do you think is lacking?
Oh, well, yeah, that's a good question. I think those questions are definitely important. The what were you doing and what's going on in your life. It's just not – until I talked to Mike about it, it didn't really occur to me to think of it that way.
Right.
But I have always looked at like other paranormal experiences in that framework, like what's going on, what's happening here, and then this experience happens. Okay, well, that's interesting. But I that UFO encounter, because it seemed like such a standalone thing, I never thought to associate it with the rest of what was going on in my life at the time. So that is a very good question to ask people. I mean, we got to assume these – I mean, from every bit of evidence, it looks more and more like these things are associated with our consciousness in some way.
Right.
So, you know, we have to ask questions that delve into that connection.
Right.
And I also think it's important to – like, I'm not convinced that when people see lights in the sky, that they're directly connected to, like, the abduction accounts.
No, of course not. I think, and I hope a lot of people are starting to realize that there's not a direct connection, and that forcibly not making a direct connection, at least for a while, would be a good idea.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at it and you say, well, people see a light in the sky, it comes down, aliens come out, they abduct them, you know. Especially back in some of the older reports. But I look at it like, okay, what if the light in the sky is a side effect of something going on, say, in the electromagnetic field?
Right.
Like Paul Devereaux showed that a lot of UFO sightings happen along fault lines.
Right.
And what if whatever's creating this, we'll call it an earthlight, for lack of a better word, is also capable of altering our consciousness and putting us in an altered state?
Yeah, that's kind of a Persinger idea too.
Right. So we're looking at this thing, and the same thing that's creating that creates an altered state. And now in this altered state, the light then becomes a spaceship that comes down, and we may very well be interacting with very real intelligences, but they're not completely in this reality.
Right.
And we're just putting onto it a thing that makes sense because our brain can't comprehend what we're actually experiencing.
Right. It's putting it in a box immediately, and then it is stuck in that box for all eternity, at least when you retell the story, remember it, and retell it to yourself. And it just keeps extrapolating away from whatever that original thing was, I would think.
And, you know, it may not – maybe they are directly connected, but it seems like most people – you know, a lot of people will see lights and not have an experience. Or people will have experiences without ever seeing a UFO.
Right.
Or you look at, you know, look at, there was an account in Whitley Strieber's, Solving the Communion Enigma.
Yeah.
Where he talks about this family seeing like a fireball streak across the sky. And right after this happened, and they're thinking a plane went down or something, their youngest son walks downstairs and says that he was just visited by his dead older brother.
Yes.
And said, you know, the brother wanted to let them know he was fine and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, why are those two things connected? Unless, of course, they're creating altered states or affecting people at some range, and the fireball was also an expression of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it flipped a switch, though you do not know which switch it is, and it may be different on different in different people.
Right, right. And I think what we need is a new understanding of reality. I don't think what we think of as reality is accurate.
Well, we're locked into our own ideas of what it might be, and it's very hard to get outside of that.
Yeah, I think I also think that, you know, the co-creation idea, you know, that we affect the reality around us by our consciousness, I think is very, very real. I think it happens on a subconscious level. I don't think just by focusing on something you make it happen necessarily. But that I think the way magic works is unconsciously. You use those symbols and those things that tap into the deeper part of your brain that actually does co-create reality with us.
I think that kind of stuff, which is why I think the occult angle is very important, is it gets you out of your own way. It fools you into thinking in some of these systems, occult systems, it fools you into looking at something else in a symbolic way so that whatever it is can manifest, react, or whatever you want to call it. And it's a very, you know, if you want to take all the magical stuff out of it, on a psychological level, it's just putting your mind in a different model so that whatever it is that's active underneath that model, you can communicate with it, even though it's through symbols, ritual, and all that.
Right, right.
And I think that's an important part of the, like I said, of the UFO thing. I was just talking to a friend today, and he said something which really made me, and I think I would like to have him talk about this on the show. What he said was that he tried an experiment. He walked out into the forest, and he imagined in the most realistic way he could possible, that there was some sort of intelligence or something, not necessarily UFOs or anything like that, but some sort of intelligence that was manifesting in that forest area that he was walking in. And he's been doing this for a while. And he says stuff has started to happen and it really made him nervous and he stopped it. And I said, does this not sound like Strieber?
Well, not only that
and I'm not saying that he made it up. What I'm saying is that he used a tool that started to edge into the same thing that a lot of abductees and maybe contactees, if you want, talk about, but they look at it as complete external reality, where it might not be. It may interact with external reality by turning on a channel or something, but the fact that he could do that to the point where he got nervous about it, like if you were conjuring up something and it whatever it was freaked you out. I mean, that's basically what he was doing. It was a magical operation. So,
well, you also have experiments where people have created ghosts where they've time
conjuring up Philip. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And there's been a few that have done this and with successful results where people experience the haunting and get the information that basically these people left behind, that they made up.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's essentially the same thing. It's connecting, and maybe there's an intelligence there, or maybe there's not. In that case, it might, you know, we may be creating a tulpa of some sorts.
Yeah, that's the word he used for it. He said, I was trying to create a tulpa of some intelligent thing that I could encounter. And he said, I think it started to tulpa-ize, at least in my, close enough to make me very nervous. Because he said, I didn't know what was happening. I kind of didn't want it to, and I stopped it.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a book from, must have been the late 80s, The Holographic Universe by Michael Talbot.
Yes.
And he had written about an experiment where they had these two little robots. And they were very simple robots, and they'd go about doing things. And one of the things the scientists noticed is that the robots had slightly different personalities. And they looked at it like one would be very shy, one would be very inquisitive, and they were programmed exactly the same. They were exactly the same robot, but they behaved differently. And they started to speculate, you know, do these things have some very, very rudimentary sense of consciousness here?
Yeah.
And if that's the case, you know, if consciousness, maybe consciousness just pervades everything. And yes. So when you have an organized system of any kind, it starts getting in there. It starts creating an individual thing
Yes.
Once the system exists.
Yeah. So go ahead.
So when you're creating a tulpa, when you're focusing on something, you're basically creating that system that eventually a consciousness could inhabit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then people call it, you know, opening a door or whatever you want to call it, but many, many different models for the same sort of thing. The other thing I was that came up on, I think it was on your show, we were talking about artificial intelligence and how I said that that book I was reading, Our Final Invention, about the dangers of artificial intelligence, that people had invented, they had written code for software, and the software was basically there to rewrite itself if it needed to. Once it learned something, it would rewrite itself automatically and, you know, continue that way so it could continue to do its job more efficiently by reprogramming itself based on new input and data.
Right.
And at some certain point, some of the programmers, the coders, were saying, these things are doing things that we did. We have no idea how they did it. We can't even go back through the code and find out how they learned how to do these things. We didn't program that they would learn how to do what they learned how to do.
which shouldn't be possible.
Right. And
it needs an external force acting on it.
Maybe, or maybe the thing is the code is so intricate and complicated and adaptable, or maybe it becomes more adaptable. I mean, it started out adaptable and just makes itself more adaptable to the point where it is gaining quote unquote experience and intelligence.
Hmm.
So and you know, the point in the book is this is rather frightening. what if it gets to the point where it says I'm going to make paperclips and it takes over the entire world to make paperclips, and all that's left is dead people and a bunch of machines mining metals and producing paperclips. I mean, that's an extreme example, but that's what he was talking about.
That would be a bizarre science fiction movie.
Yeah, it sounds like a non-funny Douglas Adams novel, you know?
Exactly. And artificial intelligence, I mean, we don't know what consciousness is. So to define whether other things are conscious is very difficult for us because we don't know exactly what it means.
Right.
Just like we don't really know what life and death are. I mean, we think, well, we know what life is. It's energy moving through but what is it really as it relates to consciousness? And if we don't understand that, how can we understand what death is?
Right. Yeah, what is it? Is it the cessation of consciousness? What is consciousness? Is it the cessation of life processes or whatever? You know, and that's another thing the guy's wrestling with in that book. You know, what if you turn off one of those computers, are you killing a consciousness?
Right. And once a consciousness is created, can it be killed? I mean, once it creates a system. You know, you get that system going, and, you know, this is where we have things like out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences. I mean, does consciousness – I guess the question comes down to the obvious one. Does the body create consciousness, or is consciousness inhabiting a body?
Yes. Is matter a prerequisite of consciousness, or does it exist without it and pervade everything? And I think – I read an article recently, and I don't know if it was Scientific American. It was a scientific journal, not a New Age journal, but a scientific journal basically proposing that, and I think we talked about this too on the show, that all matter has consciousness within it in some way.
Right.
If you broaden your definition of what conscious is, and I use that example of Alan Watts saying a rock has consciousness because if you knock on it, it makes a noise. and you can reduce that to, well, that's just a physical thing and sound coming out of whatever, but it has reacted. And if you evolve your idea of what consciousness is, that supposedly that could be conscious. And the fact that, you know, he further went and said that, you know, that consciousness may be a inherent quality of matter by explaining that if some aliens came here 4 billion years ago, there was but just a bunch of rocks, and they go, well, nothing very interesting here. And then they come back, like, you know, 3 billion later, and 3 billion years later, and things are crawling around, and they go, wait a second, there were just rocks here before. What happened? So apparently, apparently, if there's rocks, there's a chance that they're going to start crawling around and doing things and fighting each other at some point.
And the other thing is, what part of our consciousness is ego, and is that attached? If consciousness is separate, does the ego go along with it, or is the ego the thing that dies? Because the ego seems to be the thing we use to interact with the world.
Right.
And maybe these ghosts are shells of ego left behind.
Yeah, it could be. I've got more of an idea that it's like, it's that ghosts are something that had a lot of emotional content in them, and somehow that makes them visible for quite a while. I don't know how else to. It provides a recording device, if you want to be really crude about the language. That's something with a lot of emotion encoded in it, especially, you know, the strongest emotions actually are you know, despair, sadness, and all the horrible things.
Yeah.
So, or, you know, any stressful things. So, you know, you don't often see ghosts of people riding a roller coaster and having a lot of fun. You know?
That's true.
You usually see somebody doing some mundane thing, or something, you know, something horrible happening or whatever, or something around something that's happened that's horrible. So, you know, that place in space becomes unhooked from time, if that makes any sense, under the right conditions. Yeah. And that whatever was going on there just keeps, if you've got the right conditions, the right people to see it and all that, a human, you know, I don't think a camera's going to see it, but a human being sitting there or an animal will see it or sense it.
Yeah, perhaps because it interacts with their consciousness.
Right.
And maybe their consciousness then projects it, and that's when you get pictures that are just kind of like just a little off. You know, you kind of see there's something there.
Yeah.
They may be projecting onto the film itself, or, you know, but at the same time, you do see interactions, and I often wonder if the interactions are the same thing that, you know, would otherwise show up as, you know, a UFO.
Yeah, you know? maybe sort of, you know, yeah, you start to get to a unified field theory of the paranormal, which people have been looking for a while.
Yeah, and because the one of the only TV shows I'll watch that deals with this stuff is Ghost Adventures, partially because I find them hilarious. Aaron, I think his name's Aaron, the bald guy, walks into a room and says, you know, oh, I bet you've never seen energy like mine before. That's right. We don't back down. And apparently something grabbed him. He screamed like a little girl, ran down the hallway and curled into the fetal position at the end. And I was dying. You know, he has a watch on that has his pulse rate, and his pulse is at like 130 and he's freaking out. I'm like, yeah, you don't back down. You run like a little girl.
Oh, my God. See, the thing is, if he didn't, it wouldn't be a very good show. If it was just somebody that came in and said, okay, something really cool is happening, anything coming up on the instruments? Yes, okay, something just grabbed me. That was interesting. It would be very interesting to me to see somebody that was not emotionally involved. But if they weren't emotionally involved, would the stuff not happen?
Well, that could be, too.
Unless they're just faking it on the show, but whatever.
They have a guy named Bill Chappell who comes up with a lot of different equipment. And one of the more interesting things he did is he was basically running a brainwave thing on one of the guys as he's walking around and showing that just before stuff happens, his delta wave would jump up a little bit. Uh-huh. You know, and that's the more deeper unconscious wave.
Right. I didn't know that was going on while you were awake. I thought that all that stuff shut off.
It's very low.
Okay.
I think what it is.
I guess and theta so, is turned off when you're, you know, conscious, I suppose.
So it may be that that's a good way that maybe we'll figure out whether or not we're creating some of this stuff or giving it some kind of conscious energy.
Yeah.
But the other thing is he equipped a camera that basically uses the technology from a Microsoft Kinect. And so it'll detect figures in the room.
Yeah.
And sometimes it'll detect things that you can't see. And you'll see, and they've gotten pretty interesting hits, assuming they're not faking it. And I don't think they fake all their stuff. They may fake some of it. I don't really know. But every time they get something, it seems to be a little person.
Huh? What? What are these people doing? I saw this. I think I saw a bit of it. I think Coast to Coast had a link on it, or I saw it somewhere. But what are they using? A what camera? And what does it pick up?
It's a Microsoft Kinect, and it sends out a bunch of little lasers that that will send back if it detects the person. So it picks up movement when you're playing a video game.
Ah, okay.
So it's a full body thing. It just films the room.
Okay.
And so they're using it to see if anything, you know, any anomalies come up. He's retrofitted it into a camera.
Oh, I see. So they can see if something that's – there's something moving that isn't – it's either in complete darkness or is invisible if there is – if you can – if there is light.
Right. And like the first one I saw, one of the investigators started going, my head is really cold. And they had this small – what looked like a small person climbing up his back and just kind of sitting on his head. But every time they get something, it's 99% of the time, they're small. They're like 2 to 3 feet tall. And I'm thinking, yeah, well, that fits with UFOs. That fits with fairy literature. That, mm-hmm. you know, why are they small if they're ghosts?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what are they picking up?
Yeah. And are they causing this? Are they pulling it to themselves in that format?
Yeah, but I would think if they were creating it, it would be a full-size person because that's what they believe is there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even subconsciously, that thing may be the thing that, you know, what's the word? I'm talking mumbo jumbo here now, but it may be the archetypal thing that is eating away at them, or that they're looking for, or whatever. And like you said, even more fascinating is that if they're not, why are they showing up as little people? Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So and there's been every time they pick something up once or twice they've had full size apparitions.
Yeah.
You know, full-size figures showing up, but 99% of the time, they're little. And I'm like, why are they little? Why are they always little?
Yeah.
And then they start going, maybe it's a kid. And I'm thinking, or maybe it's something else entirely.
Yes.
Maybe you got a fairy on that thing, and you just don't realize it.
And they never discuss such a thing?
No.
Well, not on the show, anyway.
Yeah, they keep it very simple.
Okay. Yeah, I got a show coming out that called me that wants to do something on like weird stories in the wilderness or something like that. And
right. Well, that's popular at the moment.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens with that. But what I told them is that I am sorry, but I'm going to equivocate if you interview me. And if you can't use that, then don't come and interview me. Because I'm not going to tell you something that you want to hear. And they said, well, maybe we'll just have you read off a script, basically, of an internet account that somebody sent in of an account that happened in this place, and you can read it and say, you know, this came in from so-and-so, this happened in 1978, and this is the story. I said, sure, I'll read that. I don't care. It's not my words.
Right.
But we'll see what happens if I get on the show, how it gets twisted. I just won't say anything. I'm just going to read off the script.
And then they'll somehow get it so that you're saying, well, this happened to me. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I asked Joshua and Miguel if they had anything that they thought I should ask you. And Joshua's main one was, Soraya's personal experiences are abundant. We already talked about one of them. I've never really had a whole bunch of experience with any paranormal stuff. I've had like a few premonitions that turned out to be really, really accurate. Not anything horrible. I've seen, you know, strange lights flying. I saw one weird thing that was basically hanging motionless in the air over the beach in Santa Barbara a few years ago. But, you know, nothing really close or freaky or anything like that. It sounds like you've had, more stuff happen to you, but what about, you know, how did those affect you, and why do you think they are? And, oh, you know what? Somebody wants me to get a video of the siren going by just to show them it's not fake.
Oh, it's going by. I already went by. I can't get it. He just drove by.
Damn it. Anyway, but, yeah, as an example, you know, I don't think that, well, the thing that was, you know, near the lake sounded very dramatic, but what kind of other stuff? Not even necessarily UFO related that kind of made you go, hey, wait a second. Made you start thinking in a different way.
I can give you one of the weirdest things that happened to me. Not quite UFO related, but maybe it is in a vague sort of sense.
It doesn't even have to be anything, you know. But go ahead.
Well, this was so I have about 4 acres of land here. We're out in the middle of nowhere. We're mostly surrounded by fields, except for on one side we have a couple of neighbors. And if I walk all the way into the back, it's pitch black. I mean, you can see every star in the sky.
Uh-huh.
And so I will often take walks out there in the middle of the night.
Right.
So one night I walked out there. It was a full moon. It was beautiful out. I felt fantastic. And I walked all the way out there. And in the field behind the house, there was a light. And there's no lights out there. And I'm looking at this. And I didn't think a whole lot about it at first. It was kind of a faint light. And I'm just kind of pacing around, you know, thinking about stuff, looking at the stars. And every once in a while, I'd get a flash. Huh. Like the whole landscape would get lit up like somebody took a picture.
Right.
And I'm like, all right. I mean, this has happened a few times in my life, and I've known other people it's happened to. I have no good explanation for it. And then I started, you know, paying a little more attention to this light. And the light was definitely in the field near the ground, not moving, and it was blinking on and off.
Yeah.
And I noticed that anytime I looked at the light, it was going through like a 7-second cycle, 7 seconds on, 7 seconds off. But if I looked at it, once it went off, it wouldn't come back on until I looked away.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, I mean, this is back in probably 1992 or so. So before I had any of these concepts of consciousness affecting, you know, this type of stuff in the way I do now.
Yeah.
So I'm going, what is going on? And I'm looking up at the moon. And there's these clouds coming over the moon. And as a bunch of the clouds come over the moon literally looks like it pops through the clouds and is vibrating. And I'm looking up going, well, that's not possible. And I look at the ground and I look back up and it's behind the clouds again. I'm like, all right, well, that was weird. And then it would do it again. And I'm like, what is going on? Because I felt perfectly normal. And like I said, I felt great, actually. And so I had this light, these flashes going on, and this weird experience with the moon, which obviously wasn't physically possible. And it didn't seem to be an optical illusion, because I would think the optical illusion would be there every time I looked at it. It wouldn't wait, you know?
Right.
So my thoughts were whatever this light was either affecting me or was a result of something else that was affecting me, like on a consciousness level, that altered my consciousness enough that these things were happening, even though I didn't, you know, there was, again, no Oz factor going on, or I didn't feel weird or out of place. It seemed like any other night with this really weird stuff happening. And it went on for a while, and the light, when I eventually went inside, the light was still in the field.
What time of night was it? Like pretty late?
Yeah, it was probably like 2 a.m. or something.
So you didn't go over approaching the light from maybe an oblique angle so that you could still keep it in your field of view and check it out?
Well, I didn't want to walk into the field because I didn't know what it was.
Right.
It's also not my field.
Oh, okay.
So
and you're not Travis Walton, so.
I just kind of watched it. And like I said, I would time it. And I'd watch it out of the corner of my eye, and I could see it clearly. And it would go on, off, on, off. And then I'd look at it, and it would stay off. And I'm like, son of a bitch. Because I'm thinking, even if there's someone with a flashlight out there, there's no way they could see me at that distance and, you know, just keep the flashlight off every time I looked at it, you know?
Yeah.
Nor would anyone be expecting me to be out there at 2 a.m. You know, it's not like I did it every night at the same time where they could be like, all right, let's mess with them.
Yeah, so was this a holy shit moment or a, huh, that was interesting moment?
They're all that was interesting moments for me. I've had so much stuff happen, I just kind of roll with it. It's just like, okay, I observe. I try to, like, isolate out what my brain is doing at the time and, you know, look for explanations.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, with that, that one puzzled me for a very long time until I started, you know, learning more about the way consciousness might interact with these things. And I'm thinking, all right, you know, it may even have been a DMT release, you know, in my system.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, that explains some of the weird stuff that was happening, because it obviously wasn't physically happening. But I have had friends who have seen those flashes. I had two friends at the same time saw them. They had gotten out of their car in downtown Ithaca, and they got that flash thing, like someone took a picture, and they looked around. There was no one around. They're like, okay. And then it did it again, and they're like, that's weird. Let's go inside, you know?
Yes, that happened to me once. And it was funny. It was in a bar, and this was 10 years ago. And I was with a friend of mine, a female friend, and I was married at the time, and we weren't, you know, I wasn't cheating on anybody or anything like that. But we were drinking, and then I had this funny joke or something, and she turned and kissed me, and I thought, oh, that's pretty funny. And right when she did it, somebody took a, there was a flash. And I looked at her, and it was right, it was like it was 3 feet from us, and I looked up, and there's nobody there, and nobody's looking, and the bar was fairly all lit. There was nobody with a camera, there was nobody taking pictures, nobody had cell phones then.
Hmm.
And I was like, what the hell was that? Am I going to be blackmailed now?
John Keel reported something like that, too. He would say every time he moved, like the last day he was in the apartment or something, he would get a couple of those flashes.
Huh.
So, I mean, he said anytime he like left his apartment, you know, left to move out of his apartment, he'd get a couple of weird flashes, like someone took a picture and there was no one around.
Yeah.
And I've, like I said, I've seen them various times, you know, throughout my life, not frequently, but every once in a while. And it's just kind of like, okay, that's weird. Because you can see everything. You know, I'm in pitch black and suddenly I can see everything around me. So it's not, it's almost like something really lit stuff up, or my eyes can suddenly see what's there, or my brain is filling in because it knows what's there.
Right. Weird.
You know, I am in, on my property when this happens. So, I mean, I know what's around me.
Well, what do you make of this stuff happening to you and not other people?
I actually wonder if I have a lot of endogenous DMT in my system.
Oh, is that the model you kind of use for you have used for a while?
I think it makes sense, and it might be connected to Kundalini to some degree as well.
In what way?
Well, because I've had spontaneous Kundalini most of my life, since I was like 13.
Manifesting how?
Usually very painfully.
Uh-oh.
I went through hell most of the time I was a teenager because I had no idea what it was. I was going to doctors left and right in agony, and no one could find anything wrong with me. I'm extremely healthy. And, of course, they just thought I was making it up after a while, but it would just hit me, and like it felt like somebody was stabbing me with a burning knife and twisting.
What, like in the base of your spine or something?
Base of my spine was the most common. The second most common would be in my stomach.
Hmm.
So, you know, they thought I had some kind of, you know, digestive issue or, you know, whatever, and nothing was ever wrong with me. So this caused absolute havoc in my life, and I'm also very electrosensitive. I occasionally will really screw with electronics, and it's, you know, I suspect perhaps that's connected. I mean, if anything could set off a DMT release, it could be that.
Right, right, exactly.
I mean, I've learned how to control it now, but I mean, I can feel it when it spikes up. It doesn't generally cause me the pain it used to. Every once in a while, it'll hurt a little bit, especially if I'm moving, if I'm say, sitting at a weird angle when it suddenly shoots up.
Yeah.
And it'll be like, ow, okay, I need to adjust the angle I'm sitting at.
Oh, I'll tell you something that a Zen priest told me. And he said, and I don't know if this is relevant at all, but he said, I was in an 800-year-old Zen temple in Japan, and my mom got me a meeting with the head priest of the temple. It's the second time I've met with it was all of us. It wasn't, you know, a whole bunch of people. It was my mom and I and, you know, and my wife and my sister. And he served us tea, and we're sitting in this 800-year-old temple with raked rock gardens around us and everything. And he said, you should sit up straight. Americans don't sit up straight.
Hmm.
And he showed me. He said, look, you know, you keep your – and he was speaking in Japanese, so my mom was translating – keep your shoulders square over your spine and keep your spine straight. And ever since then, I've had no, because used to have like pains in my back and all that, but ever since then, no problem. Probably has a lot to do with just the physical structure of your back and the way it's made to carry your weight.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, that's a physical thing. And your thing sounds more like they did everything they could, and it wasn't really a physical thing that they could find out, but it had a physical, definite physical effect.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, over the years, I've realized I can spread this to other people, which is really fascinating.
And how could you do that?
One of the things it'll occasionally do to you is it'll just make you laugh. And you'll just start laughing, and you have no idea why you're laughing. Like, it's like having an insane case of the giggles. Like, you just start laughing, and it just – you can literally cannot stop. And if I grab a hold of somebody while I'm doing this, they'll start laughing the same way.
Oh, and you'll start laughing, and then you'll grab a hold of them, and somehow it transfers to them.
Right. It'll be affecting both of us, and usually scares the hell out of people, because it's not, like I said, it's not like you're being giddy and goofy. You could be totally serious when this strikes, and then, you know, you'll grab someone who's going, why are you laughing? And suddenly they can't stop laughing either.
And then when it's finished, you don't feel good or bad or anything. You're just like, what the hell was I laughing about?
Right, exactly. There are actually whole churches based around this. They're laughing churches.
Yeah.
And that's I guarantee, that is Kundalini energy that they're spreading around.
I may not be really clear on the type of Kundalini energy you're talking about. We're talking about the Hindu idea that an energy, that a some kind of spiritual energy that manifests in the base of your spine and goes up your spine, out the top of your head, if you're properly adjusted and all's well with the universe.
Yeah, it should actually go up one side of your spine and down the other.
Oh, so okay, that's right.
A circuit, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what Kundalini yoga does for you, but it does it in a very small release of energy. This is a massive release of energy. Mm-hmm. And I've met other people who have this too. I did a whole show on Where'd the Road Go about this, because I realize other people have these issues and have no idea what it is.
Uh-huh.
And once you know what it is, you can then at least focus on trying to get it under control.
Right. Or using it for the good of mankind or whatever the hell. Or at least of yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And it can be, like I said, it's very painful if it gets blocked.
Right.
And if you don't know that's what's going on, you're not going to try to figure out what the block is.
How did you unblock it?
Meditation.
Okay. And yeah, when you were meditating, were you meditating on anything or just shutting off?
I would meditate on the block, and then things would start popping into my head. It seems to be stuff that you're not dealing with.
Oh, okay.
And then as it starts coming into your head, you start understanding, okay, let's deal with this, and you kind of work your way through it a little bit, and then the block lessens.
Right. And so the energy is not blocked, so you don't have – literally, the energy is not blocked because of the emotional and mental block. So it since you're using that model, it seems to work for you.
Right. And the thing is, I didn't know anything about chakras when all this started.
Yeah.
So when I found out about chakras and realized that's where the pain was, it was always along on a chakra, it was kind of fascinating to me. Because it's not something I could have put into my personal model because I didn't know about it.
Right.
So there may be something to where these energy centers are on the body.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Well, on a very simple level, if you want to talk about acupuncture or something like that, anybody will notice, and it's happening to me right now, maybe because I'm talking to you, I'm getting itches around my body. And the thing is, you'll itch something on your leg, and then something in your back starts itching for no reason whatsoever. But if you itch in the same place, it is always shows up, and it's doing it right now, in the same place on my back. Why is that? It's because there must be something to the way signals, energy, your nervous system, whatever works.
Right.
You can take that as far as you want, and it's been taken quite far by a lot of different cultures, including the Kundalini and chakra model.
So. Yeah, yeah. I mean, once it was actually a thing in Fate magazine that woke me up to the idea that Kundalini even existed. Huh. I was just flipping through it, and it's like, hey, order this, and I'm like, okay, and I forget what it was exactly. I have it written down somewhere as I'm working on a book on all this. But, you know, they sent me this thing, and I'm reading about Kundalini and going, holy crap, this is everything I'm experiencing right here.
Yeah.
Because I'll literally pulsate. Like, my whole body will pulsate to the point where other people can feel it.
Really? Have you ever?
It happens a lot when I sleep, too.
And can you control this, or does it just happen?
It just happens.
Oh, okay.
And sometimes being around certain people will make it pulsate. Uh-huh. So, like, I must connect very well, or those people also have some level of Kundalini, and it just sets it right off.
Uh-huh.
I had a girlfriend who had very active Kundalini and had even worse control than I did.
Huh.
And one of the things I found out I could do with her is if she had a really bad Kundalini attack, I could put my hand on where the block was, and my head would just get filled with information.
Just a second. I'm trying to get this video. Oh! There, I got it. Now
Oh, well, you just recorded that some other time. Did I get it? No, I just got me yelling about it.
It's built. It's like an Oz factor with the
camera.
With the camera. No, well, I thought I hit record on it. It wasn't recording. And as soon as I said I got it, and I hit the stop button, that meant it was the record button. So there's video of me walking back from the window saying I got it.
All right then.
Yeah. Sorry, it's just a listener that hasn't really said anything before. I said, "Hey, could you please get a video of that so I can see what's going on when you're when those sirens are coming by?" And then Go Rightly keeps saying they're fake. He just plays it; it's a sound effect. I know I've been in the studio, and he has, and it's not. And he's a Discordian trickster, so of course he's going to say that.
Awesome.
I like those kind of people that mess with me. Alan Greenfield did that when he was on the show, so that was nice.
Really? What did Alan do?
Oh, he just messed with me the whole time and told weird stories and tried to say things to freak me out a little bit. And he thought that I had a more rigid format of my show than I do. Which was,
I enjoyed that interview.
Oh, you listened to it? Okay, thank you. Yeah, because a lot of people ended up liking it because Alan was very funny, and it seemed he was having a lot of fun, so I was too. Here comes another one.
I'll get it. Is it recording? Yes, it is. Oh, it's another one. There, that time it recorded it.
And where are you, L.A.?
I'm in L.A. on two major streets at, Vermont and Beverly.
Ah.
Which is right near, it's just south of Hollywood. It's about 5 minutes west of downtown. It's near the 101 freeway. I don't know how much, well, you know L.A., but anyway, it's fairly centrally located. There are two very busy streets here, Vermont and Beverly. The ambulance, fire engines, and police use them as street level freeways to get from here to there across town. So a lot of them come by during the show.
Yeah, I've noticed.
Yeah.
Although there seems to be an exceptional number of them tonight.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's some kind of weird, ambulance kundalini going up and down the streets right now.
I was actually talking to an old friend of mine to see if he remembered some of the weird stuff that happened when he was around, because other people have been around me when stuff happened.
Yeah.
And one of the ones I didn't take any notes on, but I very clearly remember, and I kind of threw it to him, and I'm like, do you remember when this happened? And I described it, and he went, yep. And I said, okay, do you remember anything else? He's like, not really, but that certainly wasn't the weirdest thing that happened when you were around. And this was, we were walking down something like 1 or 2 in the morning, pitch black, so dark out you couldn't see your hand in front of your face because there was no moonlight at all. And we're walking down the road, no flashlight, no nothing, because we didn't care and we were stupid. And he stops and goes over to the ditch to relieve himself. And I'm standing on the other side of the road, and all that's around us are fields. This is in the middle of nowhere. And all of a sudden we hear somebody walking. And they walk directly between us. We're talking. It's like, do you hear someone walking? And he's like, yeah. And we literally hear somebody walk right between us. The pace of their walking never changed. They never said anything. They never responded to us. And they just continued down the road. And I have no idea if that was a paranormal experience or not, but it was definitely a weird one, because what idiot's going to be out there at 1 or 2 in the morning without a flashlight other than us?
Yeah.
And being on a very obscure back road, like during the week, it wasn't like, you know, anywhere anyone logically would have been walking. And if it were me and I heard two people on the road in the dark, I might walk quicker or even, you know, stumble a little, like, should I slow down, go the other way, you know? And there was just nothing at all. We couldn't see anyone because we literally couldn't see anything.
And like you said, the footsteps went in between you.
Yeah.
How close were you to each other?
Well, he was standing on the edge of the road relieving himself.
Right.
And so it's basically a road. It's a country road, so it's big enough for about a car and a half. And I was standing near the far side of the road.
Uh huh.
Just waiting for him. So
a few feet.
Yeah, there was enough room for easily for someone to walk between us. It's just, and like I said, I don't know that it was a paranormal experience, but it was weird because who would have been walking on that road at that hour?
Right, exactly.
And especially without a flashlight. I mean, we were dumb enough to walk around without a flashlight because we didn't care and we were kids. But, well, kids, I think we were probably like 18 or 19 at the time. But I would assume other people would bring flashlights with them if they were walking in the pitch black.
Yeah.
So I have no idea what that one was.
Hmm.
One of the ones I know freaked him out really bad. We had gotten back from a concert and we pulled into my driveway and we turned the car off. And we're sitting there talking for a minute, and we literally hear this scream, and it sounded like it was in the car with us, and it was very, very quiet but very distinct, and it just kind of went, and then stopped, and it went on for like maybe 30 seconds like that, and we both kind of stopped and didn't say anything, and he's like, "What the F was that?" And I'm like, I don't know. Scream. We get out of the car, and I was just going to run into the house and grab something for him. He's like, "I'm not sitting out here." And he gets out of the car. I start walking toward the house. And as I'm walking under one of our big black oak trees, I see like a kaleidoscope of lights on the ground, like red, yellow, kind of like moving together and through each other. And I'm like, "Huh, lights." And I didn't really, you know, there's nowhere they could have been shining from because I was under a tree.
Yeah.
And they didn't seem to be shining. They just appeared on the ground and did this. And I said lights, and he realized how far away I was at this point and jumped. And he's like, "What? What lights? Why are you way over there?" He comes just running towards me, and I'm like, "I don't know. There were weird lights on the ground."
What do you do with all these things?
Well, that's it. I mean, I just kind of accepted them. Like, I stopped and looked around to make sure there was no source for the light, obvious source for the lights, but it was there for, like, you know, maybe 10, 15 seconds, and then they disappeared.
It sounds...
And the lights itself...
Go ahead.
The lights itself would have been weird, but combined with that weird scream or yell or whatever it was kind of like, all right, what's happening right now? Because it doesn't make any sense.
Right. So you obviously can't control any of this stuff. Just stuff happens on a random basis, and you just go, "Huh."
Yeah.
And it's never – is there any pattern to it, or is there any – like, you know, like Michael – Mike Cleland asked about your – about the sighting, what was going on in your life. Is there
right.
like – is there any – like is there a Kundalini thing associated with it, or is it just totally random whenever strange things like this will happen?
So I wrote notes from about late 1990 up to, well, mostly to present. I take less and less notes the busier I get.
Yeah.
But I was initially told to not only record stuff like that, but record what was going on around me. And I'm not really finding patterns to explain the experiences based on things around me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm finding that I had lots of dreams that predicted things that were going to happen to me, including especially people I was going to meet.
Ah.
And I realized my entire life changed around late 92 and early 93, but there weren't a lot of weird experiences in that time period. So it's, you know, I don't really know what to connect them to. I almost, it almost seems like sometimes it's, sometimes I try to take it and go, what was I supposed to learn from this? You know, like, what are they trying to show me, whoever it is that's doing this?
Yeah.
Sometimes I can come up with something, and other times, like with the lights and the yell, I'm just like, all right, that happened. I'll write it down. And it's not major. It's not, you know, like I said, the yell was, it wasn't like a loud scream echoed through the car. It was very subtle.
Yeah.
But very, very distinct. And then the lights were there for a few seconds. They weren't a massive light show. It was just a few lights on the ground that shouldn't have been there. And then they were gone. I had a note that's saying I totally forgot. I was pulling into my driveway one day, and on the right, I have a long driveway, and on the right side of the driveway, I suddenly saw what looked like a sparkler tumbleweed just kind of form, roll across the driveway, and then go out.
A sparkler tumbleweed?
Right. Like if you took a bunch of sparklers and put them together and then had it tumble like a tumbleweed, it tumbled across the driveway, got to the other side of the driveway, and just disappeared. And I stopped, watched it, went, well, that was odd. And then parked my car and went inside.
It sounds like, well, I've talked to other people that it's sort of in the same boat, but they will have a kind of an expanded awareness, and after a while, they just kind of take it for granted. It's a when I interviewed Joe McMonagle years ago, he said that this would happen, you know, premonitions would happen to him, I don't know about daily, but all the time. So after a while, he decided it was normal for him, and two, he decided to stop telling people about it. Because he says his sister did it. He had a twin sister. His sister did it, and his sister had to be institutionalized.
Really?
Yes. Or at least this is the way I remember it. I have to go back and look at the interview. But it was he said that his sister, because she insisted on telling people what was going on with her, and that she could tell things that were coming up, and had premonitions, and all this that. And she insisted that it was happening and insisted that people notice and all this. And she got a lot of negative feedback about it.
Yeah. So it seems like nowadays you can talk about this stuff without getting that sort of stigma that comes along with it. And I think, honestly, we have reality shows to thank for that to some degree.
Yeah, I guess so. It used to be you could just do this in basically, you know, California and Hawaii, and I think it's pretty much everywhere, almost everywhere you can talk about weird stuff and not be in a lighthearted way, I suppose, and maybe in a halfway serious way, not be considered crazy.
Yeah, it's and more. So many people are interested in the stuff, but I think they've always been interested, but they've been afraid of that ridicule factor.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's on television. So once it's on television, it's okay.
Yeah, well, then it's legit.
And you get to, you know, all these paranormal, like, fictional TV shows plus the reality shows. And, you know, I think, really did change the culture with this stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's, like you said, that's a good thing. Let's see.
Yeah.
I asked Red Pill what he might. I said, "What should I ask? What should I ask? I don't know. I've been working on this book, so I've been doing really little of anything else." I asked them if there was anything they wanted to ask. One of them was RPJ said was, "What's the most important thing we can learn from the UFO phenomenon?"
Phenomenon.
Yes.
Honestly, I think
he spelled it right. I tripped.
I think the most important thing we can learn from it is what we actually like what reality is. I think the key to everything hides in the true aspect of whatever is projecting the UFO phenomena.
Really? How so?
Well, I think that if we were capable of fully understanding that, we would fully understand what reality is and what we are.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's tied in deeply with, like, the deepest levels of reality and consciousness.
Yes, I'm not just saying uh-huh because I'm a radio host and going, yes, I'm listening.
I know.
It is because I agree with you. There's a quote I stuck in the book, and I'm not trying to push it or anything, but it just reminded me. Because I've been reading it so much recently just to get, you know, because I've been editing. But the quote was, I believe it was from Gray Barker. And it was the end of it was either Gray Barker or Al Bender. I'm pretty sure it was Gray Barker. But he said, if you want to, and this was a speech he gave in the 1960s, I believe. And he said, if you want to find out where the UFOs come from, look deep within yourself. And I don't think he was joking.
No. No, they're whatever these things are, and you know, I hesitate to say they're definitely not extraterrestrial. Maybe they are, but I don't see evidence supporting that they're extraterrestrial. And with all the high strangeness and all the weird encounters and all the connections to other types of paranormal phenomena, everything from the occult to, you know, ghosts and even Bigfoot sometimes, the extraterrestrial answer just doesn't work for me. Kenneth Ring doing the work with near-death experiences and showing the connections between people who had near-death experiences and abduction accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, why should there be any connection there? Why should people who have UFO encounters like Whitley Strieber see people who are dead?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, none of that makes sense from an extraterrestrial viewpoint unless they're extraterrestrial in a way that we really just don't comprehend.
No, they just know far more about us than we know about ourselves. So that's why they're screwing with us, man.
Or they're extraterrestrial and can somehow affect our consciousness in a way that we end up in this altered middle state between our reality and something else where we see things based on what's deep in our consciousness.
Right.
Now, that doesn't necessarily explain how, for instance, Whitley Strieber, on his first account, in the Communion Enigma, he talks about this. The guy he saw in one of the first encounters he had that he remembered, he didn't know was dead.
Yeah.
You know, and he only found out later when he tried to track him down because he thought he was playing a joke on him. He's like, well, that explains this. This guy is just messing with me. And then he found out he died 6 months earlier.
Uh-huh. Huh. Which book is this?
I think it was the last nonfiction one he did, Solving the Communion Enigma.
Well, you're a lot more caught up on that than I am. So I want to see the newest one, the one that he wrote with Jeffrey Kripal. I believe they're going to be on Coast to Coast on Monday night talking about that book. I will be working then, so I'm going to have to listen to it very carefully anyway.
What's this one on?
Let me look it up.
I know Jeff's work's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, he's combined his insight with what, and I'm sure somebody on Reading Mysterioso Facebook is going to go, I know exactly what it is. What it is he's combining his knowledge of mythology and, mm-hmm. Just his knowledge of mythology and, you know, how the human mind works with it, how it works on the human mind. Combining that with what Strieber has told him, and what Strieber is saying is that, well, I think now finally somebody gets it, and it, for some reason gets his experience, because he's saying that something. I think what he's saying basically is something happened to the guy, and if we look at it in terms of a mythological journey or as a mythological use those lenses on it, that it seems to make a little bit more sense. In not an external reality way, but an internal reality way, which is just as important as the external reality, especially when dealing with something as weird as this. And I think that the reason that kind of – I had a discussion online with somebody about this with Ricky Poole, who's a listener and a very smart guy. He was saying that he thinks it's kind of useless because all this stuff is made up, mythology is made up by the human mind. And my answer was, well, how much of, you know, where do we draw the line of made up by the human mind and important to us understanding ourselves and how we deal with memory, experience, trauma, and everything else?
Right.
I think that's a very – and like you said just a second ago, that the answer lies, you know, within us and how we deal with things. And if that's part of the answer or a great – or, you know, the most of the answer, then gathering more data on sightings is probably not near as important as figuring out what we think of the sightings.
True. True.
So I think that's basically what the Strieber and Kripal book is about.
That's fascinating. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, so I want to get the book. I don't think there's any chance I will get Whitley Strieber on my show. I might see if I can get Jeff Kripal, because a lot of people have told me I should read his books. I am reading one of them right now that has been stalled while I do other stuff. But Supernatural, A New Vision of the Unexplained.
I know Mike Hughes, who I have on Midweek Podcast with Red Pill and Joshua a lot, has highly recommended Kripal's work.
I just haven't gotten to reading it yet. Yeah. The Supernatural, A New Vision of the Unexplained, blah, 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 blah. Team up in this unprecedented and intellectually vibrant new framing of the inexplicable events and experiences. Probably sort of along the lines that I was saying. But Kripal, my wife is currently earning a master's and then a doctorate in mythological studies. And I went and talked to one of the professors when she went down there one time to basically get orientation. I went with her because it's up near Santa Barbara and it's a nice place. But one of the professors that teaches one of the mythology classes, he cited Kripal, as somebody that they'd had down to the university there to give a couple of lectures. I said, I know who that is. He goes, yeah, very, very smart guy. I refer to him in class, and we had him down here, and you know, I was like, oh, well, then I guess I'd better read his book. So right now I'm reading.
Which?
Let me look. It's the Mutants and Mystics.
Oh, okay.
That's what people told me to start with, that or Authors of the Impossible. So I'm starting
Authors
with
Authors of the Impossible is the one that was recommended to me.
Okay. So I think I'm reading Mutants and Mystics, and then I'll probably, if I finish it, I'll go on to Authors of the Impossible. Because I think anybody that's interested in the UFO subject should probably be reading those books, including me. Even if they don't agree with them, just to see what people are thinking and doing and doing about brain hacking, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think Patrick Harper's Demonic Reality is also really important to read.
Yes, I don't have that book, and Joshua hates me for it. And
that's because I got Joshua to read it, and he was just like, "Oh my God, yeah."
Yeah, that was recommended to me years ago, and I didn't pick it up, and I probably should now. And I'm afraid to pick it up because I'm afraid it's going to change my mind about a lot of things. Actually, I don't think it'll change my mind a lot about a lot of things. What it'll do is enrich the already deeply held beliefs I already have.
Well, it's very much along the lines of what we're talking about. It just gives it a different framework to work with.
Uh-huh.
And when I had him on my show a couple of years ago, that book came out in, I think, like 1992 or 1993, and I had him on, and I'm asking him questions, and I'm like, so you said this, and he went, really?
Yeah, exactly.
That's really interesting. I mean, I don't remember saying it, but I'm glad I did.
Yeah.
And he's a funny guy, and he's very down to earth, and you know, it's just been so long since he also wrote a book on alchemy as well, and another one that was really interesting on the soul, as well as a few other things, I believe.
Ah, yeah. See, the only thing that people know that in our racket know about is Demonic Reality. So,
yeah, I talked to him about the one about the soul. I haven't read the alchemy one yet, so. That's I think his first book, and I don't even remember what it's called. And I think he wrote a fictional book about his time growing up that he just kind of took his life experiences and turned it into a story. And I think he's been working on a fictional book on Fortiana-type stuff and the demonic reality-type stuff.
Hmm.
And I don't know if that's done yet. I forgot to ask him last time I talked to him.
I would like to be the kind of an author that's exciting enough that that people are very eager to read, because I know so many people eager to read, like, you know, Kripal's next book, or, you know, if Patrick Harper's writing another book, or if Valet writes another book, because those kind of ideas are the kind of things that people really chew on and that change things, because they're so well argued and so compelling. And, you know, it takes something that somebody, you know, this is the best recipe for any system of thought. It takes something that everybody knows about and basically pulls it in another direction that makes sense, and then it pulls things forward and moves the entire thing forward and changes the conversation. That's what I was trying. Something that changes the conversation is always exciting. And something that changes the conversation in a lasting way. And there's very few people that can do that.
And for a while, I got really sick of UFO books because so many of them were just basically rehashing the same ideas.
Yes.
And it was like, oh, and here's more proof that Roswell happened. And it's okay.
That's changing. That's changing quite a bit. And it's wonderful to see. Everybody is wondering, what's ufology going to do now? I think it's going to completely democratize and basically go in 100 different directions, which is great.
Yes, absolutely. What was interesting, the guest I had on Where Did the Road Go this week, Seth Breedlove, has done a couple of movies on cryptids. He'll take like a small town cryptid. I think his company's Small Town Monsters. And so like he did like the Minerva Monster, which was a weird Bigfoot encounter. He did one in the Beast of Whitehall. And the next one he's doing is the Boggy Creek one.
Oh, okay.
And when I watched these, there was no mention of UFOs. But when I was talking to him last night, he then said, well, yeah, in the Minerva account, there was tons of UFO sightings around it. And then we're talking about Whitehall, and he's like, and I, because I said something like, it almost seems like a UFO flap. And he paused and went, well, there were UFO sightings happening. He's like, one woman had a UFO land right on her front lawn and leave a huge burn mark. And other people were reporting UFOs at the same time that these monster sightings were happening. Yeah. And I'm thinking, how can people, you know, and you get the UFO people will research the UFOs and ignore the monster sightings, yeah, and then vice versa. And it's like, no, these may very well be connected. You have two weird things happening in the same place. How can you ignore that?
Yeah, you have two non-standard things going on, and sometimes three or four or more.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there were Bigfoots running around, too, and that people are having poltergeist activity in their houses at the same time.
That, and sometimes you can't, like, you know, one of the things with one of these monsters, it would, you know, throw rocks. And I'm thinking, yeah, poltergeists throw rocks, too. Why is this a monster and another a poltergeist?
Yeah, Bigfoot throws rocks.
So, well, these were Bigfoot sightings, essentially.
Oh, okay.
But they were just like, and the one in Whitehall, New York, had red eyes. And I'm going, oh, Kiel's red-eyed monsters. All right.
Yes. Yeah, and well, many other places too, but yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, animals don't have red eyes generally, so.
Not that, normally.
That kind of, again, suggests a paranormal sort of element here, not a flesh and blood creature.
Right. Oh, well, here's an obvious question for you. And I know which side probably you're going to come down on. Bigfoot, real monster or paranormal event?
Yeah.
Flesh and blood or paranormal?
I would lead toward paranormal, although there may be flesh and blood elements to it. I know, like, talking to someone like Lyle Blackburn, I mean, I sat there for like an hour talking to him about this, and he insists he's never seen any other paranormal activity around cryptid encounters he's, you know, investigated. And it's like, okay, I mean, really? That's why he believes it's a flesh and blood creature. And I'm like, well, I can understand that point. But then you have, like I said, these cases where you have UFO sightings, and the one family he was saying had reports of like a cave that suddenly appeared one day and was gone the next day. They went back, and a whole bunch of other weird paranormal stuff going on with them. And I'm thinking, you know, when you say that, it makes me feel like this really is probably not a flesh and blood creature. Maybe it's a flesh and blood creature when someone sees it, you know, like it leaves physical marks the same way a UFO can leave physical marks, but it's not really a spaceship.
Right.
And this is where I think we're lacking some understanding of what reality really is and how it works.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't think that we have, you know, you look at every UFO report where someone see a structured craft and most of them are different.
Yes.
So do aliens just only make one-of-a-kind spaceships?
Yeah, you know, there's a few of the same. That's something that Chris Albeck mentioned the other day when I was talking to him. He said when somebody said flying saucer in 1947, and that was we talked about this too. Flying saucer was a term that had been around since the 1880s.
Really?
But it was used to refer to flying targets for skeet shooting.
Oh, okay.
And he said he found references to it. He mentioned this on Coast to Coast too, but he found references to it multiple places, the words flying saucer. So he said what he thinks is that term was readily available to people, to news reporters and everything else, because it was, he said he seems to think it was common enough in the public lexicon that it was very easy to shove that in as the term for what Kenneth Arnold saw. Because they move right, like saucers skipping on the water. Oh, flying saucers, like those things that people used to shoot at with shotguns.
That makes a lot more sense than now that you say that.
Yeah, and the other thing that we spoke about was, well, see how the language capitulates what, and he brought this up, capitulates what people saw. When somebody says flying saucers, are people going to see round things with rings around them? Are people going to see triangular-shaped things? Or what are they going to see? I think a lot of them are going to be front-loaded to see, you know, flat discoid things.
Yeah.
And that may have affected what people saw by encoding it in the language and then making that basically the template in the brain.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the Grays, before Missing Time and Communion came out, the reports were a lot more varied as to what kind of creatures these people, different people were encountering.
Yeah.
But once those got into the sort of common view of it, suddenly the grays were the majority thing, but only right. in countries where like communion was published.
Right.
When you went to countries that it wasn't published, it was still a variety of, you know, hairy gnomes and giants and all kinds of other stuff.
Right. And acting in a different way too.
Yes. Yeah. So, it implies either every one of these is made up, which I really, I mean, to think that is almost crazy at this point because there's so many from so many different places that have the same archetype, even if they seem like different encounters.
Yeah.
And, I mean, yeah. So, or this is where our consciousness comes into play. Our unconscious puts that face on it.
Yeah. And it may be borrowing from something that, does, you know, a collective unconscious is something we're not even aware of.
Right, right.
Because it's just in the zeitgeist or whatever the hell you want to call it, if you want to get mystical about it, which I do.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I mean, and I'm sure you know, like the first UFO that ever made a car stall was in a comic book or a fictional story or whatever. And that
didn't know that. Uh-oh, you got cut off
again.
And
suddenly they started causing cars. Oh, really?
There we go.
Yeah, it was in a fictional story. Am I back?
Hello? Yes.
Okay.
You seem to be back.
It was in a story somewhere where the UFO hovered over a car and caused it to stall.
Yes.
That had never happened prior to that, and then it started happening in real life.
That's weird too, because I can't find it, but I once wrote a piece called "Why Don't UFOs Stall Airplane Engines?"
Huh.
Because they see them in airplanes, they see them in piston-driven airplanes, and they've never really stalled an airplane engine. And it went back and forth for a while with people on the list, and finally we figured out, and this is before I started flying airplanes, airplane engines are different than car engines. There are redundant systems in them. You have instead of a spark plug in each cylinder, you have two. There are also two magnetos going to power those spark plugs. And it's redundant system, so that might be part of the reason why it just doesn't work on the airplane engines, because one system gets messed up, the other one will take over for it and keep the engine going. And that seemed to be the answer. But yeah, the weird thing was it just wouldn't happen with airplanes. But then you go to a deeper thing, it's like, well, maybe that archetype doesn't exist, so it won't work.
Well, maybe, or whatever they are stalling the cars out intentionally.
Yes, that too. I mean, if you want to get to the conscious intelligence that inhabits whatever the things people are seeing, yes, you can figure it's like, well, if I make the airplane engine stop, he's gonna have to land.
Or crash
somewhere where you can't, you know, and a lot of these accounts happen at night. So you'd have to find you'd have to land somewhere where you can't see. So maybe there's some compassion being shown by the UFOnauts. I don't know.
And you could also, you know, if you just want to throw out an idea, you could say, well, maybe if there is something coming up from the Earth and an Earth energy that's also creating these lights, that Earth energy could be interfering with a car engine. But the planes are far enough away from it that it's not happening.
Ah, maybe so. Yeah. I always get kind of scared of a purely physical explanation. I don't know why that is. It's probably because most people jump to that, you know?
Well, I don't think it explains the UFO interactions. I think it might be a conduit. Like I always liked Andrew Collins' idea for what UFOs are, which are plasma intelligences.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, and that these things, we just don't understand that they're actually intelligent creatures, and that he also suggested, what he suggested is that when we come in close contact with them, it creates sort of a bubble reality.
Meaning a third reality that does not exist when either of us are on our own.
Right, right. And I'm not sure that's what's happening. It was definitely a unique and different take on it, and I really liked it. And I think he may be onto something with the plasma to some degree.
Yeah, I would put the plasma in quotes, meaning it's something like that, but not exactly what we would call the third state of matter plasma.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's the same, you know, like he investigated Marfa, you know, the Marfa lights, where these lights, these balls of seeming plasma, plasma seem to show some sort of intelligence where they come towards you, and if you try to move toward them, they take off.
Right. Or, I'm sorry, fourth state of matter. It's a solid, liquid, gas, plasma. There we go.
Yeah. And so he compared that to different, you know, portal areas for UFO reports. And he's like, well, you know, whatever these areas are may be prime for generating plasma the same way that the Marfa area is.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're intelligent and they can interact with us, but they can't interact with us on strictly our level, they're creating another reality in between us.
Yeah. Well, that, you see, there's a almost democratic co-creation.
Yeah. Yeah.
My co-creation idea is there's a precipitating event that really doesn't, you know, well, this is, you know, a sort of idea, a precipitating event that doesn't really give a shit what we do about it. And then we assign all the meaning and everything to it after that. I think that's operant in many encounter cases.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely could be.
Yeah. I'm not sure, but it's, you know, one model. Joshua asked something else. He said, I'd find it interesting to compare and contrast your journeys, both of you, from ETH interest to the acceptance of the weirder reality of the subject.
Yeah.
Did you have an ETH, like kind of a hardline ETH thing going for many years for yourself?
I wouldn't say it was a hardline. I mean, I read, even though I read Jacques Vallée, to me, reading Vallée's stuff was like, okay, so he's suggesting that these UFO people were masquerading as fairies and stuff. It didn't kind of take the extraterrestrial out of it. Reading Bud Hopkins' work, I thought Hopkins made a great argument for the extraterrestrial reality. It's just that when you start digging in deeper, you find out, well, he's leaving a lot out. You know, there's so much stuff he didn't cover, and so it was actually Kenneth Ring's work that finally broke that with me, because when I saw that connection between near-death participants and abduction participants, it's like, all right, extraterrestrial doesn't work here.
Yeah.
And it also made me question what near-death experiences are.
Really? In what way?
Well, because, I mean, we assume that a near-death experience is what happened when we die, but we don't know that's the case.
Right, because nobody comes back from it to tell us that gets all the way there.
Right, and unless you want to trust channeled entities or people who can speak to the dead, and even those don't match up with near-death experiences.
Yeah, exactly.
So it really makes me wonder what the near-death experience really is. I think, I mean, I'm fairly convinced at this point our consciousness is not confined to our bodies. Right. I think there's more than enough evidence of that. I think there's more than enough evidence of things like telepathy. I've had some, you know, we were just talking about prophetic dreams and stuff like that. I mean, that kind of hints that consciousness is not just a side effect of matter, because there's no reason these things should happen. You shouldn't have out-of-body experiences. You shouldn't have near-death experiences. If that were the case. And I totally forgot where I was going with this.
We were talking about moving from the ETH to a more nuanced view, or at least an idea that doesn't explain everything.
Yeah, and with near-death experiences, I think it's another level of experience. And you can see the change. I mean, people who have near-death experiences come back changed.
Yeah.
So when people try to say, oh, it's a hallucination, really? Because hallucinations don't change people. Not on the level that near-death experiences do. You know, someone gets into an accident, almost dies, they come back, their IQ is higher. Well, that shouldn't be. If anything, they should have more problems, not less problems.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly they see the world in a much better light. I mean, I can understand if you're afraid of death, like most people are. I mean, understandably, it's a big unknown. And you die and you come back. Well, that's going to change your outlook on the world. But most people understand when they're having a hallucination. You know, it doesn't have that impact. People don't come back from hallucinations generally saying, this reality doesn't feel as real as that one.
That's true.
And, you know, that's common in both extraterrestrial abductions and near-death experiences. The woman I had on a few weeks ago, Cheryl Lee, she had three near-death experiences in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had asked her, you know, because she said, yeah, it feels more real than this reality does. And I asked her what that means exactly. And she said it felt like you're picking up everything all at once, as opposed to being separated out by your senses.
Yeah.
It's like almost like pure information.
Yeah, I believe either we talked about this on your show or I've talked about it recently. It's that more real than real seems to be a result of your entire senses being taken over by the experience. And there's no anchor for it except for that experience, which would make it more real than real.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, the work that's done on near-death experiences is fascinating, and I don't understand why they still get dismissed other than the fact that people are still stuck in this materialistic paradigm.
Because, I don't know, there's a whole hell of a lot of reasons. There's, you know, ego, There's needing to be right. There's testosterone. There's okay. I need to earn a living. I don't need to worry about this BS. There's so many excuses. Some of them are pretty good.
But I mean, there's no good counter arguments for these experiences.
No, really. No, not at all. Not to me.
You know, these people are experiencing something. And like I said, it may not be what happens when we die, but they're definitely experiencing something real. And yeah. In a state where they shouldn't be able to experience anything.
Right. And they seem to be and they're fairly consistent. Now, some people have argued that's because that's what you're, you know, when your brain's shutting down, that's what it does. But I keep coming back to, well, a few things like what's that guy Stevenson's thing with kids and the reincarnation and how do they know things that they're not supposed to know about people that they never knew that live so far away from them. And the right. other one is, you know, what. Things like, you know, how did the woman see the shoe on the ledge of the hospital out yes. there where nobody could see it?
And that's one of my favorites. I mean, that's just such a classic.
If it's true.
I've never seen anyone debunk it, but I mean, I guess it would be hard to really determine whether or not that happened unless you could track down all those people.
Right.
Because it was the doctor who went out and checked the ledge for the shoe and found it.
Yeah. And there's, you know... It's just to the point where you've reached this critical mass of so many stories, especially before any of this stuff really spread, like very early yeah. on. And there's not a model to hook it into. You know, people have been saying some of this stuff before, you know, Life After Life and Moody and all these people.
Yeah. And the fact is that these people have very distinct after effects, no matter what the experience is. They're having after effects that you do not see in people who have not had these experiences. So if someone dies on the operating table and they bring them back to life and they don't have a near-death experience, they don't have all these after effects that somebody who had a near-death experience do.
Right.
And one of those is also electrosensitivity and kundalini awakening.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Hey, Gorightly was asking about that because he missed that part.
Ah,
I said, okay, I'll put it on to play after I leave here. I will replay the show from tonight. Unedited.
Oh.
Not
is that unusual?
Huh?
Is that unusual?
No. Every once in a while when I leave, I will say, here is an encore presentation of Radio Mysterioso.
That you edit it.
No. I edit almost everything that I broadcast when it's podcast because this one, I don't think it's going to need too many edits, but there'll be things like where, you know, I will very occasionally say something I don't want to repeat. That happens occasionally. Or I'll say something insulting that I don't really want to repeat. Or there will be a lot of big pauses. Mm. Or the person makes funny noises in between with their mouth or something that, like if somebody's clicking and making funny noises, I will go through and edit those out.
Well, that's dedication.
Just because people don't realize, they're like, why do you take so long? It's like, well, I'm doing 100 things, and I want the thing. This is forever, and right. I'm an audio person, so I'm very anal retentive about audio stuff.
I had interviewed John Ward at one point, and well, a few times, but one of the interviews I did with John Ward, I cranked up the compression on it before I put it up because it was low on a couple spots. And I was like, okay, yep, that sounds better. And then I put it up. What I didn't realize is it could pick up me breathing fairly easily.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, why are you breathing so heavy into the mic? And I'm going, oh, it's the compression.
Yeah.
Because the, you know, the mic picks it up, but you don't hear it until you crank up that compression and bring all the levels up, and then you're hearing every little noise in the background.
Yeah. Do you do this at a radio station?
Yes.
Huh. Yeah. Because if usually the way the mics are at the radio station, if you go anywhere off to the, you know, off to the side like this, I've got a nice Sennheiser microphone. If you go anywhere off to the side like that, it'll cut it down. Or if you get like maybe 2 feet away, you can't really hear what's going on anymore. But yeah, it'll still pick stuff up.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, because you've got, you know, multi-$1,000 mics in that studio, I'm sure.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Which is why I like doing interviews live at the studio, but it's not always possible. Because I don't want to, you know, if I'm interviewing someone in the UK, I don't want them getting up at 4 a.m. to do an interview.
Yeah, that's the same with me. I could have not interviewed Chris Aubeck in Spain because it's 8 hours after me, or 9, something like that. So I can't really do that because it'll be, you know, he'll have to get up at what? Like 4 a.m.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want to make him do that. So since he was so gracious to even talk to me, I was like, okay, I'll deal with his schedule and just pre-record it. So,
yeah, and a lot of people are in the UK that I end up talking to, I realize.
Oh, okay. I haven't interviewed anybody in the UK in a while. Most of the time, they're either from this country. Miguel will be on every once in a while. You know, if Walter's with me, he just drives in from where he lives. So,
right,
yeah, a lot of my stuff. And as I get, you know, further down the road here, I will probably be interviewing more people not live, which I don't really like. Until I switch over, because I want to try and start doing it from home. If Kill Radio goes in the toilet here and there's nothing I can, and I can't help it, and it just goes. I've actually told some people on the Roddy Mysterioso thing, I'm a podcast prepper. I've actually got a mixing board, like a 4-channel mixing board, and, you know, a set of microphones and a mic stand, like one of those nice radio ones that hangs the microphone above your head on one of those arms.
Mm-hmm,
and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I've got that ready to go at my house in case this thing goes, and then I'll be doing it live from my house using some live streaming service. So I don't plan to have the show go away. I would really like to keep doing it because I get to talk to people like you.
Well, even if you don't do it live, you can always put it up on the places like you on iTunes and stuff.
It is on iTunes. It's when I post it goes on iTunes. And on my site, and you can listen to it on the site, and you can listen to it. You can download it if you want, all totally 100% for free, just like yours, I'm sure.
Yes. Oh yeah, absolutely. I put it everywhere I can.
How did you?
I just want people to hear it.
Yeah. How did you get the use of the facility at a radio station? And this is live on the radio when you do it, right?
Yeah. Well, I've been at the radio station since 1994.
Oh, okay.
So I'm basically what happened is I've had a heavy metal show there,
right,
which I hesitate to call it a heavy metal show because even though I play metal, we do a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, of course,
and
you have
through the years, I mean, I changed the name from the Metal Cage to the Last Exit for the Lost because I thought it was more fitting. And, you know, we do comedy skits. We play music. We play comedy music. We play a lot of variety of stuff. We have bands come in. I interview actors. I interview basically whoever I want. Because I want to, you know, and hope people find it interesting.
Right.
And I would occasionally try to throw paranormal conversations into it, but the problem is none of my co-hosts really knew this stuff.
Yeah.
They would be people who were interested in it, but I couldn't have a conversation with them about it.
No, because most people aren't really that interested in it in a deep way like you are.
Right, and so it never really stuck, and at one point I said, you know, I kind of want to do a show like, you know, Coast to Coast and then all these other shows I'm listening to. And I wasn't sure I could. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to talk to someone for an hour and not sound like an idiot. And so the first show, the first person I interviewed was Walter Cruttenton, and I interviewed him on the music show.
Uh-huh.
And I just, you know, I messaged him because I really liked his work. And I said, hey, would you be willing to come on my show and talk? And he's like, yeah, give me a call. So we talked for a little bit, and then he's like, yeah, I'll come on the show. And it went great. It doesn't sound that great because I was using the phone system at the old studio, which had a bit of a hum in it, and he was kind of low. But people can find it online if they want to listen to it. And what I did is I interspersed it with music about, you know, yuga cycles and stuff.
About what?
Yuga cycles.
What is that?
That is essentially the great year. Yuga cycles in India are the, depending his view of it, he uses the 24,000 year cycle, which is the precession of the equinox.
Oh, okay. This isn't like the Hindu whatever the multi-thousand year cycle ending with Kali Yuga, is it?
It is.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Apparently, there's two different ways of looking at it, and he chooses to look at it from the equivalent of the Greek Great Year mm-hmm. and the precession of the equinox, because they all match up perfectly.
Oh, okay.
And his whole theory is that there's another sun out there, that we're rotating around another star.
Oh, okay.
And I find it interesting and fairly compelling, honestly.
Uh-huh.
I think he might be right. But, you know, so he was the first person I talked to, right. And, you know, I got done, and I'm like, was that all right? And he's like, that was great. And I'm like, okay, now I'm going to ask the radio station if I can just have an hour to do this. And they were like, yeah, sure, go ahead. So basically I'm on from 11 p.m. on Saturday night till 6 a.m. on Sunday morning every week.
Is that both your shows?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I do an hour and a half for Where Did the Road Go, and then I go into The Last Exit for The Lost.
Uh-huh.
And in some cases, like, I'll have people stick around if they have something that fits the show. I mean, Peter Robbins lives 10 minutes away from the studio.
Yes.
So he'll come in. Like, we did a mid-afternoon show with him and Richard Dolan where they played their favorite jazz stuff.
Yes, I heard about that.
And that's on my page somewhere, too, on wheretherodgo.com. Peter's come in and stayed around for The Last Exit for The Lost, and at one point we did a tribute to his late sister, Helen Wheels.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that fit fine. So he just went through, picked a bunch of her songs, and we talked about her and did that. You know, so that's always fun to do because it gets a different take on people. I tried to get Lyle Blackburn to stick around to talk about Ghoultown.
Yeah.
But at the time, Ghoultown was defunct, so he didn't really want to get into it. But now it's back together, so... Karen Crisis, who's a medium, I had her on, and I've known her from her band. So after she talks, she stuck around and talked about her new band. So anytime I could do a crossover like that, I enjoy doing it.
Yeah, I haven't had a crossover with somebody that's written a cool book and also is into extremely strange music. But except Joshua, we had a weird music off a couple of months ago, which is something I still have to post as well.
Oh, interesting. I heard him play the tuba on there and thought it was fairly interesting.
Yeah, well, he played the tuba at the end of the show. Yeah, his interview, because I thought, yeah, oh, that'd be interesting. And
it was. I didn't know people could play tubas like that.
I think I had heard of that before, but it was just so cool hearing him do it live on the show. Yeah. And I don't know why I'm reminded of it, but one time I had Scott Corrales on, and I said... who's your favorite, you know, Hispanic or Spanish UFO researcher? Or one of them, he said, oh, he named somebody. And I wish I could remember the name. And I said, well, what's one of your favorite passages that they've written? He said, oh, it was about when the guy was staying over at a person's house and he basically saw some gray or something walk by the door. And he's never had an abduction experience. And it was very strange, disconcerting, frightening, and all that. And he wrote it up. And I said, go ahead and read it. He goes, okay. And he starts reading it and he's translating. I said, no, read it in Spanish. Read the entire thing in Spanish. Do not translate it, and don't translate it afterward. Well, he did because he told me what happened. He told me up beforehand, and then afterward he tried to tell me more. I said, "No, don't translate it." I understood about 70-80% of it anyway, but don't translate it because I don't know why I said that. I just wanted to hear it in Spanish. An account of somebody seeing a gray walk by the door and being freaked out by it in Spain, like, you know, in the 80s sometime, in Spanish.
Huh. I remember we also had someone come on to talk about, actually in studio, to talk about H.P. Lovecraft, who had written a bunch of stuff, basically tearing down the belief that the Necronomicon was a real book.
Right.
And he did him and another author did all this research and just basically showed where all the stuff came from and how this, you know, the guy who was, they kind of picked out who it was who likely wrote this thing up. And it was pretty interesting. We talked about Lovecraft and his impact on culture. And then when we went into The Last Exit, I mean, there's tons of H.P. Lovecraft influenced metal and goth music.
Right.
So we played a bunch of that. And then we talked about his, H.P. Lovecraft's movies and things like that and his impact on music and movies and things like that. So that was a great tie-in right there.
Mm-hmm.
But Yeah, I mean, that's always fun to do. I'm trying to get Mike Clellan down because he's about 3 or 4 hours away from us now.
Oh, that's not very far.
No. And I want him. I'd like to get him and Peter on together. But I also was talking to him about doing an afternoon show where he gets, 2 hours to pick his favorite music and stuff. It's interesting. It tells you, it gives people a different view of someone when they can hear them just being themselves and playing music they love and not just talking about this stuff.
If you see Richard, and I should ask him this myself, but what I still want to do is have him on the show and not mention UFOs once. I want to hear about his 19th century baseball stuff that he does. I want to hear about his academic career. I want to hear about what the kind of music he likes. Where he's been in the world.
Yeah.
You've been all over the world. What are some of the cool places you've been? What's the strangest thing that's happened to you when you were like speaking at a conference in Italy or something? Did you see the Pope come out and give a blessing or something? Just some weird thing, but not UFOs. Because every other show he's been on, including mine, he's going to talk about UFOs. I did this with Peter Robbins, too. We did one show where we didn't talk about UFOs at all. We talked about him tramping through Europe when he was in his 20s. And actually more India and Afghanistan. And a bit through Russia, too. And it was amazing.
Peter has a really interesting history.
Yeah.
And of course, he also knows quite a lot about Wilhelm Reich and actually worked with one of Reich's main people.
Yes. Yeah, that did come up during the show right at the end. We talked a little bit about Reich and about... Jerome Eden, I think, might have been the person he worked with. I can't remember. But, yeah, there was a small circle of people that worked with Reich originally, and Peter had known at least one of them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I told him I had a copy of Contact with Space, and he said, what? The Reich Museum was selling them one time when I was a member of, I was a supporter of the Reich Museum in Maine. In the 90s sometime, and they sent out a little thing saying, we have a few copies that we found of Contact with Space that happened to be sitting in a box in the basement. And I was like, what? And we're selling for $150 a piece. Take my money. And I got one.
Really? And Reich, I think, was on to something, too. I think, when you look at Reich's work, I think you're seeing a little bit of Kundalini energy there as well.
Right.
It's just being called orgone energy instead. Uh-huh. I mean, because Kundalini has a strong sexual component too. I mean, I'm trying to remember the exact phrase that gets used, but it's like the sexual component in man and the God force and all this other stuff. But I think it connects to a lot of this other stuff. It's just being viewed from different lenses.
Yes, exactly. And he's trying to quantify it and measure it and concentrate it and all that with devices, whereas the Eastern people are trying to use it somehow in its its natural form, but the way that the body would use it, and not by sitting in a box that's supposed to concentrate it.
Right.
Not that that's wrong, but yeah, I know what you're saying.
So I always found his stuff interesting, and the way he dealt with UFOs, is fascinating.
Yeah,
because again, it kind of pulls away an extraterrestrial component and says, well, what are these things really? If he can literally summon them with these devices,
yeah,
and they don't show up like, hey, this is a spaceship flying down from space because we saw your bat signal.
Yeah, or it just affects it affects the local environment in a way that the things become visible or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's always fascinated me, too. Andrew Collins, one of his early books, Alien Energy, starts talking about infrared photography and UFOs and how they will sometimes show up on these film plates.
Oh, yeah. Trevor Constable used to do that.
Yeah, and I remember seeing the old show UFO Hunters, which I thought was generally pretty bad. I would watch it anyway. And they ended one week with a shot from a military helicopter. Or not a military, a police helicopter.
Is that the Long Beach thing?
I think so, where they had the thing on the infrared, but they couldn't see anything behind them, and it kept following them.
Yeah, I think I've seen that one. Supposedly it was, I guess, from the Long Beach Police Department.
And you can hear them going, there's nothing there. What the hell are we looking at? And, just talking about it. And it's like, okay, that's interesting, because how many of these things are around us and... We have no idea because we only perceive a very small amount of what's actually there.
Yes, yeah, that's the I think part of the super spectrum idea of Kiel.
Yes, yeah.
There was a guy in the 90s, I think. I met him in Roswell when I was speaking in Roswell one time. Or no, this was in 2007 because I remember it was the 50th anniversary. But anyway, he came by the table. I was sharing a table with Nick Redfern. The guy came by and he said, you should come on one of my sky watches. We use night vision equipment and just look up at the sky.
Huh.
And we see all kinds of stuff they wouldn't normally
see. That's awesome.
And I've never done that. And strangely enough, the other person that told me that was, who's the guy that had the Orgone Laboratory in Oregon?
Don't know.
I can't remember his name now, but he was building Cloudbusters and stuff up in Oregon using Orgone energy. He was up in Oregon and, I can't remember his name. Anyway, he told me the same thing about 10 years before that. He said, you should get some night vision and look up at the sky at night. You're not going to see just stars. You see a lot of other stuff that you normally wouldn't see there. Huh. And since then, I've wanted to do that, but I don't have access to night vision equipment. It actually was one of my wish list things. Have a really decent night vision setup so I could look up in the sky or go out to Area 51 or go out to any number of facilities out here in California at night and just sit there on a weeknight, which is probably the best time to do it, with night vision and just watch the sky.
Yeah, yeah. I had when we're talking about perceptions and stuff, like I said, a lot of times I walk away from these experiences going, what were they trying to show me here? And one of the weirdest things that's ever happened to me, along with that light in the field, when I was a teenager, we had built up. So one of the places where a bunch of my friends lived is the psychiatric institution right next to it. And they had a potter's field up on this cliff that overlooked Seneca Lake.
Yeah.
And we would go up there just to hang out. And eventually we realized there was enough bushes around the edge of the cliff that we kind of built a hidden bench so you could go and sit there and overlook the lake and just hang out. And it was an awesome place to go. And one day we're up there, and three of us are on one side, and another one is sitting over at the bench on the other side. And while we're standing there, you can't see the potter's field. I mean, it's completely covered by bushes and stuff in between us. And the big tree sitting there just starts moving on its own. And from the other side, we're hearing like ka-clump, ka-clump. We can feel the ground moving. And we're thinking, oh, my God, there's like a giant buck on the other side of this, like grinding its horns into the tree or something.
Yeah.
So my two friends start freaking out, and I calmly walk along until I can see the other side. And as soon as I can see the other side, it stops. And there's nothing there. And I walk out all the way over there, and then my one friend's yelling, what's over there? And I'm like, there's nothing over here, and there's nothing in the field. So I walk back around, and I get back to where we can't see again, and it starts doing it again. And I'm like, huh, all right. And my one friend is losing his mind at this point. He is absolutely livid. And my other friend suddenly goes, what are you guys freaking out about? And my freaking out friend goes, the tree moving. He's like, I don't see the tree moving. And we both just stopped. It's like, you don't see the tree moving and you're not hearing this? And he's like, no, everything looks normal. What the hell are you guys talking about? And then they both got more freaked out and we're like, can we leave now? And it's like, yeah, maybe we should leave now. And I'm sitting there thinking about that and I'm like, what was this supposed to show me? And I'm like, maybe it's showing me that really reality is not necessarily the same thing for everybody.
Right.
You know, perception, I mean, and the funny thing is when I wish I could
be shown that so well. When I can, just thinking about it, it's totally different than living through it.
Right, right. But the funny thing is, like when I was remembering this, I'm thinking, okay, the one who was freaking out about it must have been the guy who was always with me when weird stuff happened. And it turns out he was the one who didn't see anything.
He didn't want to see it. He just got tired of it. His subconscious just said, forget it. We're shutting this off now.
But it was such a major thing. I mean, the whole tree was moving and the ground was, you know, if you've ever been around a horse or something, when they stomp down on the ground, you can feel it vibrate. It felt like that.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I have no idea what's going on, but I'm even more fascinated by the fact that you're not seeing it. Like, if it was me seeing it and him not seeing it, I'd be like, okay, maybe I'm crazy. But I had someone else seeing it and then another person not seeing it, and I'm like, wow, this really says perception is not what we think it is. It is not perfect by any means.
Yeah. Oh, Go Rightly wrote in the guy in Oregon is James DeMeo.
Ah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Go ahead. This happened in broad daylight, too.
Oh, really? For some reason, I'm picturing it at night.
Nope. Broad daylight. A lot of weird stuff happened up there.
You're a strange attractor.
Yeah, but certain areas have had more things happen than others. And that area, lots of stuff happened. And I'm sure people would say, well, it's a potter's field. There's spirits there. Maybe. I don't really know. I mean, there's an old Jewish graveyard there. There's a Civil War graveyard there.
Graveyards don't have hauntings. Really?
Well,
nothing happens there.
The thing is, I've been in two graveyards where that's not true, where they're very active.
Really? In general.
Yeah. Every other graveyard I've been has been, well, dead.
Yes.
but both of these graveyards are very old. And what I wonder is, when they built these graveyards, did they build them in sacred spots?
Hmm.
You know, where stuff was already happening, and they said, well, it's a sacred spot, let's put a graveyard there. As opposed to modern graveyards where they go, all right, where do we have space?
Yes. This one was maybe somebody doused for it or something.
Maybe. I mean, and the one in Ithaca that has all the activity, there's a bunch of graveyards in Ithaca, and only one has activity, and lots of people have experienced stuff there, goes way back. I think it goes back to like the 1700s.
With stuff going on since then?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I only know people recently who have had experiences.
There's an interesting research project.
There's also the fact that it is only about two blocks away from a Buddhist temple. And from what I've heard, the Buddhists consider that area to be the third most powerful energy spot on the planet.
Wonder how they determined that one.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anything else going on there? I mean, like UFO sightings, strange creatures, other weird stuff?
Well, it's right at the base of the lake that all the UFO sightings happen.
Oh, okay.
Strange creatures, I'm not aware of any strange creature sightings. There's one of the guys I had on who runs an antique shop. He has gotten in contact with this woman who back in the 60s, her car was actually picked up by a UFO.
In that area?
Yeah. Yeah. We're trying to actually – he's very carefully – because she's in her 80s, I think. She's very carefully trying to see if we can go and interview her about it. Because I haven't heard a lot of cases where cars actually get picked up.
Right. It's not unheard of, but no.
No, but it's rare. And being local, I figured, yeah, if you can set this up, that would be fantastic.
Right. I have kept you over 2 hours, 2 hours and 10 minutes. Would you like to keep going a little bit, or would you like to continue this at another date or on your show?
It's totally up to you. I'm fine either way.
Okay. Believe it or not, I had no questions written down. You're the first person I've ever talked to who I haven't interviewed on my show before where I did not write something down. And it's amazing actually it's not that amazing because you've been through so many things and have, you know, some of the, our interests, so many of the same things that I think we'd probably keep talking for another 4 hours.
Probably. I realized in listening to your shows, I'm going, yeah, we think the same. All right.
Yeah.
And even our approach, I started my show because I wanted to talk to people.
Right.
You know, and from what I understand, that's kind of why you started doing stuff.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you read something, you hear about something, it's like, what ticket do I need to talk to this person privately?
Yeah.
Well, even not privately, you have to do the show. It's like writing about things. It's like, I'm going to write about this thing, but I'm not writing about it because I want to write a book. I'm writing about it because I want to find out about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to force myself to find out about this thing that I'm so interested in.
And the guests I pick, about 50% of them are people where I'm going, I want to talk to this person, and I want to see if I can learn anything that's going to help me understand stuff better.
Yeah. Not just their thing, but, you know, to open up about that thing. You know, the first person I ever interviewed was Robert Anton Wilson.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was almost by accident, because I had just started reading his books, and I'd come out of this horrible deep depression, and he had his books basically kept me from wanting to kill myself.
Wow.
And he said, yeah, people tell me that all the time. Like, it wasn't any big deal. I didn't tell him that till after I'd known him for, like, maybe 8 or 9 years, though, because I was too embarrassed to tell him that. But the thing was that my friend Robert Larson was a co-producer of a conference up in San Francisco, north of San Francisco in Mill Valley. And, you know, there were all kinds of people speaking there. I can't even remember who the other people were. But I do remember that Wilson was there. And there was a backstage meeting, like, of all the speakers. They all just sat around a table and talked to each other. And I, for some stupid reason, I saw this was happening. I just inserted myself into the... I just sat down at the table with everybody. And they, you know, they went around the table, who are you, who are you, who are you? And I said, I couldn't think of anything. So I said, I'm a writer for the Los Angeles Weekly. Total big fat lie. And
but it
then,
got you in.
Yeah, it got me in, and I got to talk to a bunch of different people and hear all these great things. I was, you know, it was like a fly on the wall with a bunch of incredibly intelligent, forward-thinking weirdos. And at the end of it, Wilson was sitting there by himself at the table. I said, you mind if we sit down and talk for a little bit? He said, no, sure. And I had a tape recorder, and I sat down and talked to him for like half an hour.
Wow.
And I was nervous as hell, and it turned out great.
Well, that's how I felt the first when I did that interview with Walter Cruttenton. I've been interviewing musicians for, you know, basically since probably around 1991, 1992, and sometimes very big name musicians. I've talked to Bruce Dickinson for like an hour once. Did an interview with him. Did interviews with people who I almost idolized.
Yeah,
as close as I come to idolizing people, and never been nervous. And when I went to call Walter Cruttenton that first time to talk, just to talk to him, not even to interview him, I'm like, I'm nervous. Holy crap.
Yeah, because it suddenly it's personal. I mean, the music is personal and all that. But, you know, I've interviewed musicians and all that, people I really like, not really like ridiculously famous people. But it doesn't have the same effect of I didn't interview him, but going to meet John Keel in New York. I almost stuttered the first time I met him. It was like, gug. And he was very nice, but he was extremely polite and cool and talked to me.
When I called Walter, I think part of my issue is because I had never talked to someone who really did this research. It was always just people I knew who maybe read some books here and there or interested. Yeah. Like, am I going to find out I'm a complete idiot and don't know as much as I feel like I do?
Yes, exactly. I know that. I know that one, yes.
And the more I talked to people, the more I was going, okay, all right, I'm a little more confident in what I know. But it took me a long time. I didn't talk much about my experiences or anything much in the early part of the show. And people would always be like, you should talk more about this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know.
You should, because the thing is, at first you think, it's a big ego thing. It's like, no, it's not. You know why you're doing this show? You're doing the show to find stuff out. And to be able to find stuff out, you have to deal with your own stuff, which is far richer than, you know, probably a lot of the people that you talk to on your show. So you have to bring that up.
And I've always been the type of person who listens. I don't necessarily talk a lot.
Oh, I talk way too much.
So it was always hard for me to suddenly, you know, be like, okay, so I'm going to talk about stuff. The first time Micah had me on the Grailian Report, I was nervous. You know, and that was probably 2 years ago now. And I was like, okay, now I'm nervous again because now I'm going to be interviewed. I'm not the interviewee. Or I'm not the interviewer.
Yeah. It's like anything. It's just like, you know, you get used to it. It's not that big of a deal. The second show I was ever on was Coast to Coast with Art Bell. I was nervous as hell.
I bet.
And it really showed, too. So, and unfortunately, I wish I'd known what I was doing back then because I would have probably gotten a little better show. But it wasn't that big a deal because everybody remembers it because Richard Doty was on. Which is I suggested he be on, and I called him up. So that was a very strange, weird little coincidence there, and it really helped because I didn't have to talk a lot of the show. After the first half hour, they brought him on, and all I did was sit there and listen and say things every once in a while. Like, you know, right before the end of this first hour, I said, weren't you involved with Linda Howe and bring her onto Air Force Base, the Kirtland Air Force Base one time? And Bell was like, you met with Linda Howe? Oh, my God. And so, it became I kind of enabled them to talk about it, which was great. But, yeah, I was really ridiculously nervous. I'm still nervous when I talk to people sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Depending on who it is, definitely.
Talking to Aubeck, and even when I interview people, anybody I haven't talked to before, there's like this little twinge sometimes, and sometimes more of than that, of just like, I don't want to sound like an idiot, you know?
Yeah, I don't want to screw this up.
Yeah. And it usually turns out okay. No matter how many times it usually turns out okay, I'm still a little nervous. So
I'm always worried I'm going to go blank at the worst possible time.
Oh, I've done that. But that's what editing is for.
Well, but when you're live, you can't really edit that out.
No, I can't. But you know what? It's like, so what if I screw up? Nobody's paying for it. Nobody really cares. And it's actually part of the show when I screw up. I don't like it. I don't plan for it. I don't say, hey, we're going to have this screw up here and it's going to be really cool and funny. It's just like, no, I'll forget what I'm talking about. I will run out of questions. I won't have listened to exactly what the guest said, and they have to repeat it, and I feel like a total asshole. But nobody really cares that much, you know?
One of the things I hate the most is when I'm talking to someone and they're telling me something interesting, and then something happens in the studio. and I'm going, what's going on over there? What's – oh, crap, I haven't been listening. You know, and it's like, all right. How can I fake it here? And it's because I wasn't interested. It's that bad just happened in the other room, and I'm going,
Yeah, well, I have no producer, so people are writing me on Facebook or messaging me or whatever, and I'm sort of trying to keep track of that and talk to the guests. And every once in a while, I'll say, could you please repeat? I did it today when I was talking to you. Could you please repeat that last little bit?
Yeah,
you know, and I'm not scared to do that anymore because it's just kind of like, well, for whatever reason, he didn't hear or whatever, and I'll repeat it. Nobody minds.
and I'm sure there's always, if I ever got to talk to John Keel, I'm sure I would have been nervous as hell.
Yeah. The second time I wasn't not nearly as nervous as hell. Both times we went out to lunch, and the second time it was just a friend of mine, Skylar, and me and Keel just eating lunch in New York, you know, near his apartment somewhere. And we just hung out for like an hour, had lunch, and then went out in the street and took a picture with him. And that was it. And that's the last time I saw him. And he signed a couple books for me. And I'm exceedingly, ridiculously lucky to have met him.
Yeah. Yeah. If I could have interviewed anyone in history, you know, of this type of stuff, he would have been pretty much top of the list.
Yeah, I never got to interview him because I was, one, too nervous to do it. I just thought, I can't interview John Keel. And the other thing is, by the time I thought maybe I could do it, he was kind of too old to really deal with it or want to do it.
Yeah,
Ken Thomas gave me a recording of an interview he did with him in the 90s, and it's posted on the Radio Misterioso site. So there is an interview with Keel on the site, courtesy of Ken Thomas. So.
Hmm.
I didn't have to do the interview. Ken did it. That's where I got that piece where he said, you know, the extraterrestrial thing is not a viable theory here that's at the beginning of the show.
Oh, right. I love that.
Yeah. I stole that off that interview that Ken did.
I was also super nervous talking to George Hansen.
Oh, yeah. That's somebody. See, you've interviewed all these great people that I've never touched because either I didn't think of it or I'm totally nervous.
And Hansen's brilliant.
Yes.
And his book is so deep that, yes, you know, like I read it and I would read one chapter and be like, okay, I need to put it down until tomorrow.
Yes, exactly.
And even then, sometimes I'd go back and reread the same chapter and be like, okay, I think I got it. And that's not normal for me. Normally I fly through stuff. I pick it up very quickly. And that one was just, it was so dense.
Yes, it's information rich. Bruce Duensing's stuff like that, it was like that with me. And I was ridiculously nervous talking to him when he was on my show. So,
And so when I asked him and I didn't think he was going to respond. He's like, sure, I'll come on. Give me a call first. And I'm going, oh, okay, great. So that way you can assure.
He's
going
to hate me.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the conversation I had with him was actually better than the actual interview.
Yes, that's usually how it goes. In fact, I'll do that with people. I'll go like, can we like save this for the interview, please? Because we're going to be repeating all this.
Yeah,
and at that point, they're usually just like, yeah, this is going great. Sure, yeah. So,
or you'll forget what you asked them talking to them ahead of time versus during the interview.
Yeah, but if I repeat it, I'll just say, look, I'm going to probably repeat some of this. And they say, yeah, that's fine. They don't mind.
No, but I mean, like, you'll ask them something at the beginning of the interview, and as you're going,
Oh, yeah.
Did I ask them about that, or was that when we were talking?
Yeah. How long have you been doing the show?
As of January 26th, 3 years.
Okay.
And the last I've been trying to get Mike Cleland and Aaron Gullius on as close to the anniversary every year since, I think, the second year.
Yeah.
Or first year anniversary, yeah, because they worked so well together, and I was like, oh, let's do a show on UFOs for the, you know, the new year, and
yeah,
they were perfect. And then we decided, let's do a UFO history, which has now taken a full year to do,
right?
Because we don't approach it with, okay, you know, this happened and that happened. They're looking at the cultural impact. Mike Cleland's looking at, you know, a different angle of what these experiences mean,
right?
And, Aaron's fantastic with the history and the culture and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And it just, you know, we got...
I would never have thought to put those two together to do that, because they've both been on my show, I think, multiple times.
They are fantastic together. They complement each other great. They have completely different views of the stuff, and it works fantastic. Huh. I am happy I put them together.
That's a great idea. I mean, that's big congratulations to you for that. Inspired.
And it's amusing because, you know, Aaron's not interested in the abduction accounts, and that's mainly what Mike is interested in.
Yes. but he knows enough about everything else. Mike knows enough about the field that he can roll with just about anything, I would think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they're so respectful of each other's views. There's not any arguing or, you know, hurt feelings anywhere along the line, because they're very open-minded, you know.
Right.
And looking at the history of UFOs that way, actually, we're doing the next one this week. I think we're up to the late 90s. The 80s took us like two or three shows.
Wow.
You know, because so much happened, and we just kind of took it apart and looked at it different ways, looked at what was happening in the culture and, you know, the impact it had on the culture and things like that.
You're so organized. You're making me feel terrible.
I didn't have any notes for any of that stuff when we went through it. I think the 1980s, the second part is where I first started laying out, let's make sure we talk about this stuff, because I think we got through most of the 80s and never mentioned things like Rendlesham. And then I'm going, yeah, we never cut. All right.
You mentioned Cash Landrum?
I think we did, but
it's the same day or the next day, I think, wasn't it? Yeah. Yep.
But, I mean, we were trying to cover so much stuff. It just, you know, and I'm like, I write to them, I'm like, we never mentioned Rendlesham. And they're both like, huh. Nope. No, he didn't. So we started with that on the next show. But time I made a list. I'm like, okay, let's make sure we get all these major points as well as everything else we're going to talk about.
Wow, that's a really great, like, you know, two points of view UFOs 101 series.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people have complimented, you know, have been like, oh, this is my favorite thing on UFOs I've ever heard. And I'm thinking, great, because I love it.
Yes.
I love letting those guys talk.
Yeah. It's so cool when you do something because you really want to do it and you think it turns out really well. And then people say, that was really cool. And you're like, what? It was? Yeah. I didn't think anybody else would be interested. I just had so much fun.
And what I find is that people, there's a big difference between the people who download it on iTunes and the people who will listen on YouTube.
Really?
So iTunes is pretty steady as far as however many thousands of downloads I get.
Right.
And it doesn't go up and down that much varied on the show. But when I put it on YouTube, they still get a pretty steady number, and then suddenly they either jump way up, depending on the guest, or they just kind of stay around there. And it's very guest-oriented on YouTube, even though I have something like 8,000 people subscribed to the channel.
Really? That many? I don't have nearly that many subscribed to mine, so at least I don't know. Oh, your YouTube channel?
Yeah, YouTube.
Oh, I don't even have a YouTube channel. People just pull stuff and then put it up there, and I don't even notice. I guess I should. I mean, if I want to be organized about it.
I like YouTube. I never thought anyone would actually listen to the show on YouTube.
Oh,
I
they do,
that
yeah.
was a thing. I'm glad they do, and they leave a lot of intelligent comments on the stuff.
Yeah.
You know, every once in a while, there's the troll comment here and there, but they're very in the minor category there. I get a lot of useful information.
Yeah.
The last time I had Steph Young on, somebody not only gave me the name of a place I was trying to think of, but they also had discovered one of the stories she relayed turned out to be a hoax. And he, you know, presented me with all the info so I could pass it along to her, and she went and edited it in her book.
Oh, perfect.
So it's like, okay, this is great to have it on YouTube, but it is very, like, UFO stories don't do as well on YouTube. So as much positive feedback as I've gotten on the series with Aaron and Mike, YouTube does not have that same impact. But if I have Steph Young talking about, you know, strange disappearances or David Politis or someone like that, they go through the roof.
Right.
Anything with Bigfoot, people really like on YouTube.
Yeah.
So it's like you can see
that. It's probably a big search term, you know.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm figuring. And it's kind of interesting to me what people are focused on.
Right.
I wanted as many people to hear it as possible, so I put it everywhere I could.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I should think that way. The only thing way I thought that way was putting up the website. It's like I want to make it as easy as possible for anybody to listen and in as many ways as possible. And that, I guess that did not include YouTube.
Well, I actually took time, and I haven't done it in like a year, but I'd post them to Usenet as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, good idea.
I just toss them in the paranormal group. It takes a while to upload them because I have a slow upload speed, but I would just dump them all up in there, and I'd get a bunch of comments back, thanks, this is great, and I'm like, cool.
People still use Usenet?
Oh, yeah.
Really? I haven't been on it in probably, what, 8 years or something?
It's shifted a lot because of piracy and things like that.
Oh, okay.
Because they try to cut down on it. But Usenet's really hard to cut down on, honestly, because it doesn't have the hard trail that, like, torrents and stuff have.
Right, right.
But it's definitely died down a bit since, you know, in the last 10 years. But there are still a decent number of people who use it.
Huh.
You know, we've done... I did a bunch of listener story shows that were really interesting. You know, that was just kind of a random, huh? I wonder if, you know, people kept writing me with these stories, and I'm like, you want to come on and talk about them?
Yeah, I've had that happen a couple of times, yeah.
A couple of them turned into full shows. Actually, the one with Cheryl Lee, I didn't realize she had written me about my show on Kundalini.
Yeah.
And I didn't know who she was, and... I was just like, hey, do you want to talk about your Kundalini experiences? And she's like, I don't know, maybe. And eventually she came on and she's like, don't you want to know who I am first? And I was like, sure. And she sends me like a talk she did at a near-death experience conference and all this other stuff. I'm like, wait, this is a show. This isn't just a short little, you're going to come on and talk about your Kundalini.
Yeah.
It ended up being a two-part show, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stuff like that's happened to me, too. Yeah,
I had a guy with a Bigfoot tail, and as he's telling this story in detail, it's, you know, 30 minutes, 35 minutes, 40 minutes, and I'm going, all right, it's just going to be its own show.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting stories I got was from a guy who was I want to say he was a pastor. I don't remember for sure right now. But it was something that he took as sort of a demonic encounter. But it came across to me with so many elements of the typical abduction experience that it was really interesting to see that contrast in perception. You know, to him, he's being, you know, tortured by these demons and they left marks on his body and this and that. And I'm thinking, this is so UFO abduction account without the UFO.
Yeah.
He was also had a nightmare hag type experience where something where this creature crawled on his chest and kept pushing him down into his couch.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things is it broke the slats on his couch on the bottom.
Really? Huh.
So you know, he's initially thinking, well, it was in my head. I don't know if that really happened. And he went to move his couch at one point and he realized the things on the bottom were broken. And the only way it would have happened is from pressure from the top.
Right.
And so that story was fantastic. I mean, because it really in him telling that story, it made me think about all these other different connections between all these different phenomena and the way we look at them.
Yeah, because in one person here, you're already having the crossover, and he doesn't even realize it.
Right, right. And, I mean, it was a traumatic experience to him. And he had his own interpretation of why it happened. And to him, it was that he was experiencing all these negative emotions towards somebody. And that's what drew this stuff in. And I'm thinking, well, very well may have been. It may not have been demons. I mean, maybe it was. I mean, we don't.
Whatever. Whatever filter you're going to use this time.
Right. It doesn't. I can't say it's not demons. We don't really know what these things are, so we can't really say what they aren't. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I mean, it that may very well have drawn this stuff in and opened him up to it.
Yeah.
Can I plug some stuff real quick?
Yes, of course. I was about to ask you to do that.
So my show is on. It's live on Saturday nights, but you can just go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. The entire archive is free, so you can go download any show you want. They're all up on YouTube. Plus, there's a bunch of video interviews up on YouTube, both of people telling their own stories and a bunch of videos with Peter Robbins. I've had Lyle Blackburn. I have one with John Anthony West and Laird Scranton. Just anyone I've been able to get in person, I'll do video interviews with. So all that stuff is up there. There's a couple of free books up there. I have Peter Robbins' one book there that he released, Deliberate Deception, that's available on there.
Right.
As well as a book on Darwin and how Darwin basically stole the entire theory of evolution. The guy I had on was really interesting. He used to work for the BBC, and the book is out of print, and it sells for a fortune on Amazon, so I offered to put it up. He didn't want people buying it because he wasn't getting the money, and it was just ripping people off. And
yeah.
So I offered to put it up, and he thought that was a great idea, so people could just download the PDF of that book for free.
Right. That's a great idea.
So, and if anyone's interested in the music show, you can check that out at thelastexit.org. I can't make those downloadable, but there are archives where you can just stream the show and check out old shows and stuff, and a bunch of interviews. And if you want to hear the stuff with Peter Robbins and Rich Dolan and stuff, it's in the Dealer's Choice section of the archive.
Excellent. You wanted me to play this song, Mouth of God, by Mechanism.
Yes, Mechanism. This is my favorite thing that came out last year. They're a band from Florida. The vocalist is very into shamanism, and they just blew me away. This is their second EP.
All right. Well, Soraya, thanks so much for coming on the show, and of course we'll do it again. And anytime you want me to come by and talk too much on your show, I'm happy to do so.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, here's Mouth of God by Mechanism, requested and sent to me by Soraya here, our guest tonight.
Thanks, Greg.
All right, thank you.
Shaman. Before I was born. The legend inside us, the spirit reminds us from the mouth.